He opened the passenger door of the cruiser.
What I want is a nap, but I won't get one, because there's a lot to do. I've got big responsibilities. I didn't ask for them, but I have them.
Some men are great, and some men have greatness thrust upon them. Isn't that so, Jim?
Julia asked. She was smiling her cool smile.
Big Jim turned to her, and the expression of naked hate on his face made her fall back a step. Then Rennie dismissed her. Come on, Chief.
The cruiser headed back toward the mill, its lights still flashing in the hazy, oddly summery light.
Phew, Joe said. Scary dude.
My sentiments exactly, Barbie said. Julia was surveying Barbie, all traces of her smile gone.
You had an enemy, she said. Now, you have a blood foe.
I think you do, too.
She nodded.
For both our sakes, I hope this missile thing works.
The second lieutenant said,
Colonel Barbara, we're leaving. I'd feel much more comfortable if I saw you three doing the same.
Barbie nodded, and for the first time in years, snapped off a salute. 18. A B-52, which had taken off from Carswell Air Force Base in the early hours of that Monday morning, had been on station above Burlington, Vermont, since 10:40 hours. The Air Force believes in showing up early for the prom whenever possible. The mission was codenamed Grand Isle. The pilot commander was Major Gene Ray, who had served in both the Gulf and Iraq wars. In private conversations, he referred to the latter as Big W's fuck-a-monkey show. He had two Fast Hawk cruise missiles in his bomb bay. It was a good stick, the Fast Hawk, more reliable and powerful than the old Tomahawk, but it felt very weird to be planning to shoot a live one at an American target. At 12:53, a red light on his control panel turned amber. The COMCOM took control of the plane from Major Ray and began to turn it into position. Below him, Burlington disappeared under the wings. Ray spoke into his headset.
It's just about showtime, sir.
In Washington, Colonel Cox said,
Roger that, Major. Good luck. Blast the bastard.
It'll happen,
Ray said. At 12:54, the amber light began to pulse. At 12:54 and 55 seconds, it turned green. Ray flicked the switch marked 1. There was no sensation, and only a faint whoosh from below. But he saw the Fast Hawk begin its flight on vid. It quickly accelerated to its maximum speed, leaving a jet cone trail like a fingernail scratch across the sky. Gene Ray crossed himself, finishing with a kiss at the base of his thumb.
Go with God, my son, he said.
The Fast Hawk's maximum speed was 3,500 miles an hour. 50 miles from its target, about 30 miles west of Conway, New Hampshire, and now on the east side of the White Mountains, its computer first calculated and then authorized final approach. The missile's speed dropped from 3,500 miles an hour to 1,850 as it descended. It locked on Route 302, which is North Conway's main street. Pedestrians looked up uneasily as the Fast Hawk passed overhead.
Isn't that jet way too low?
A woman in the parking lot of Settlers Green Outlet Village asked her shopping companion, shading her eyes. If the Fast Hawk's guidance system could have talked, it might have said, You ain't seen nothing yet, sweetheart. It passed over the Maine, New Hampshire border at 3,000 feet, trailing a sonic boom that rattled teeth and broke windows. When the guidance system picked up Route 119, it slipped first to 1,000 feet, then down to 500. By now, the computer was in high gear, sampling the guidance system's data and making 1,000 course corrections a minute. In Washington, Colonel James O. Cox said,
Final approach, people. Hang on to your false teeth.
The Fast Hawk found Little Bitch Road and dropped almost to ground level, still blasting at near Mach 2 speed, reading every hill and turn, its tail burning too brightly to look at, leaving a toxic stench of propellant in its wake. It tore leaves from the trees, even ignited some. It imploded a roadside stand in Tarker's Hollow, sending boards and smashed pumpkins flying into the sky. The boom followed,
causing people to fall to the floor with their hands over their heads. This is going to work, Cox thought. How can it not? 19. In Dippers, there were now 800 people crammed together. No one spoke, although Lissa Jameson's lips moved soundlessly as she prayed to whatever New Age oversoul happened to be currently claiming her attention. She clutched a crystal in one hand. The Reverend Piper Libby was holding her mother's cross against her lips. Ernie Calvert said, "Here comes." "Well," Marty Arsenal demanded, "I don't see nothing." "Listen," Brenda Perkins said. They heard it come. A growing, otherworldly hum from the western edge of town. A mmm that rose to mmm in a space of seconds. On the big screen TV, they saw almost nothing. Until half an hour later, long after the missile had failed. For those still remaining in the roadhouse, Benny Drake was able to slow the recording down until it was advancing frame by frame. They saw the missile come slewing around what was known as Little Bitch Bend. It was no more than 4 feet off the ground, almost kissing its own blurred shadow. In the next frame, the Fast Hawk, tipped with a blast fragmentation warhead designed to explode on contact, was frozen in midair about where the Marines' bivouac had been. In the next frames, the screen filled with a white so bright it made the watchers shade their eyes. Then, as the white began to fade, they saw the missile fragments, so many black dashes against the diminishing blast, and a huge scorch mark where the red X had been. The missile had hit its spot exactly. After that, the people in Dippers watched the woods on the Tarker's side of the dome burst into flame. They watched the asphalt on that side first buckle, and then begin to melt. 20. "Fire the other one," Cox said dully, and Jean Ray did. It broke more windows and scared more people in eastern New Hampshire and western Maine. Otherwise, the result was the same. In the frame. 1. At 19 Mill Street, home of the McClatchy family, there was a moment of silence when the recording ended. Then Norrie Calvert burst into fresh tears. Benny Drake and Joe McClatchy, after looking at each other over her bowed head with identical what-do-I-do-now expressions, put their arms around her quaking shoulders and gripped each other's wrists in a kind of soul shake.
"That's it?" Claire McClatchy asked unbelievingly.
Joe's mother wasn't crying, but she was close. Her eyes glistened. She was holding her husband's picture in her hands, had taken it off the wall shortly after Joe and his friends had come in with the DVD.
"That's all?"
No one answered. Barbie was perched on the arm of the easy chair where Julia was sitting. I could be in big trouble here, he thought. But it wasn't his first thought. That had been that the town was in big trouble. Mrs. McClatchy got to her feet. She still held her husband's picture. Sam had gone to the flea market that ran at Oxford Speedway each Saturday until the weather got too cold. His hobby was refinishing furniture, and he often found good stuff at the stalls there. 3 days later, he was still in Oxford, sharing space at the Raceway Motel with several platoons of reporters and TV people. He and Claire couldn't speak to each other on the phone, but had been able to stay in touch by email. So far.
"What happened to your computer, Joey?" she asked. "Did it blow up?"
Joe, his arms still around Nori's shoulders, his hands still gripping Benny's wrist, shook his head.
"I don't think so," he said. "It probably just melted."
He turned to Barbie. "The heat might set the woods on fire out there. Someone ought to do something about that."
"I don't think there are any fire engines in town," Benny said. "Well, maybe one or two old ones."
"Let me see what I can do about that," Julia said. Claire McClatchy towered over her. It was easy enough to see where Joe had gotten his height.
"Barbie, it would probably be best if I handled this on my own."
"Why?" Claire looked bewildered. One of her tears finally overspilled and ran down her cheek.
"Joe said the government put you in charge, Mr. Barbara, the president himself."
"I had a disagreement with Mr. Rennie and Chief Randolph about the video feed," Barbie said. It got a little hot. I doubt if either of them would welcome my advice just now. Julia, I don't think they'd exactly welcome yours either. At least not yet. If Randolph's halfway competent, he'll send a bunch of deputies out there with whatever's left in the fire barn. At the very least, there'll be hoses and Indian pumps. Julia considered this, then said, "Would you step outside with me for a minute, Barbie?" He looked at Joe's mother, but Claire was no longer paying them any attention. She had moved her son aside and was sitting next to Nori, who pressed her face against Claire's shoulder. "Dude, the government owes me a computer," Joe said as Barbie and Julia walked toward the front door. "Noted," Barbie said, "and thank you, Joe. You did well."
"A lot better than their damn missile," Benny muttered.
On the front stoop of the McClatchy home, Barbie and Julia stood silent, looking toward the town common, Presteel Stream, and the Peace Bridge. Then, in a voice that was low-pitched and angry, Julia said,
"He's not. That's the thing. That's the goddamn thing."
"Who's not what?"
"Peter Randolph is not halfway competent. Not even one quarter. I went to school with him all the way from kindergarten, where he was a world champion pantsweater, to 12th grade, where he was part of the bra-snapping brigade. He was a C-minus intellect who got B-minus grades because his father was on the school board, and his brain power has not increased. Our Mr. Rennie has surrounded himself with dullards. Andrea Grinnell is an exception, but she's also a drug addict. Oxycontin."
"Back problems," Barbie said. "Rose told me." Enough of the trees on the common had shed their leaves for Barbie and Julia to be able to see Main Street. It was deserted now. Most people would still be at Dipper's discussing what they had seen, but its sidewalks would soon fill with stunned, disbelieving townsfolk drifting back to their homes, men and women who would not yet even dare ask each other what came next. Julia sighed and ran her hands through her hair.
"Jim Rennie thinks if he just keeps all the control in his own hands, things will eventually come right side up. For him and his friends, at least. He's the worst kind of politician. Selfish, too egocentric to realize he's way out of his league, and a coward underneath that bluff can-do exterior of his. When things get bad enough, he'll send this town to the devil if he thinks he can save himself by doing so. A cowardly leader is the most dangerous of men. You're the one who should be running this show."
"I appreciate your confidence.
But that's not going to happen, no matter what your Colonel Cox and the President of the United States may want. It's not going to happen even if 50,000 people march down Fifth Avenue in New York waving signs with your face on them. Not with that fucking dome still over our heads."
"Every time I listen to you, you sound less Republican," Barbie remarked. She struck him on the bicep with a surprisingly hard fist.
"This is not a joke."
"No," Barbie said, "it's not a joke. It's time to call for elections, and I urge you to stand for second selectman yourself."
She looked at him pityingly. "Do you think Jim Rennie is going to allow elections as long as the dome is in place? What world are you living in, my friend?"
"Don't underestimate the will of the town, Julia."
"And don't you underestimate James Rennie. He's been in charge here for donkey's years, and people have come to accept him. Also, he's very talented when it comes to finding scapegoats. An out-of-towner, a drifter, in fact, would be perfect in the current situation. Do we know anybody like that?"
"I was expecting an idea from you, not a political analysis." For a moment, he thought she was going to hit him again. Then she drew in a breath, let it out, and smiled.
"You come on all aw shucks, but you've got some thorns, don't you?"
The town hall whistle began to blow a series of short blasts into the warm, still air.
"Someone's called in a fire," Julia said. "I think we know where."
They looked west, where rising smoke smudged the blue. Barbie thought most of it had to be coming from the Darker's Mills side of the dome, but the heat would almost certainly have ignited small fires on the Chester's side as well.
"You want an idea? Okay, here's one. I'll track down Brenda. She'll either be at home or at Dipper's with everyone else, and suggest she take charge of the firefighting operation."
"And if she says no?"
"I'm pretty sure she won't. At least there's no wind to speak of, not on this side of the dome, so it's probably just grass and brush. She'll tap some guys to pitch in, and she'll know the right ones. They'll be the ones Howie would have picked."
None of them new officers, I take it.
I'll leave that up to her, but I doubt if she'll be calling on Carter Thibodeau or Melvin Searles. Freddie Denton, either. He's been on the cops for 5 years, but I know from Brenda that Duke was planning to let him go. Freddie plays Santa every year at the elementary school, and the kids love him. He's got a great ho-ho-ho. He's also got a mean streak.
You'll be going around Rennie again.
Yes.
Payback could be a bitch.
I can be a bitch myself when I have to be. Brenda, too, if she gets her back up.
Go for it, and make sure she asks that guy Burpee. When it comes to putting out a brush fire, I'd trust him rather than any town fire barn leftovers. He's got everything in that store of his.
She nodded. That's a damn good idea.
Sure you don't want me to tag along?
You've got other fish to fry. Did Bren give you Duke's key to the fallout shelter?
She did.
Then the fire may be just the distraction you need. Get that Geiger counter.
She started for her Prius, then stopped and turned back.
Finding the generator, assuming there is one, is probably the best chance this town has got. Maybe the only one. And Barbie?
Right here, ma'am, he said, smiling a little. She didn't.
Until you've heard Big Jim Rennie's stump speech, don't sell him short. There are reasons he's lasted as long as he has.
Good at waving the bloody shirt, I take it.
Yes, and this time the shirt is apt to be yours.
She drove off to find Brenda and Romeo Burpee. 2. Those who had watched the Air Force's failed attempt to punch through the dome left Dippers pretty much as Barbie had imagined. Slowly, with their heads down, not talking much. Many were walking with their arms about one another. Some were crying. 3 town police cars were parked across the road from Dippers, and 6 cops stood leaning against them, ready for trouble. But there was no trouble. The green chief of police car was parked further up, in the front lot of Brownie's store, where a hand-lettered sign in the window read, "Closed until freedom allows fresh supplies." Chief Randolph and Jim Rennie sat inside the car, watching.
"There," Big Jim said with unmistakable satisfaction. "I hope they're happy."
Randolph looked at him curiously. "Didn't you want it to work?" Big Jim grimaced as his sore shoulder twinged.
"Of course, but I never thought it would. And that fellow with the girl's name and his new friend Julia managed to get everyone all worked up and hopeful, didn't they?"
"Oh, yes, you bet." "Do you know she's never endorsed me for office in that rag of hers? Not one single time." He pointed at the pedestrian streaming back toward town. "Take a good look, pal. This is what incompetency, false hope, and too much information gets you. They're just unhappy and disappointed now, but when they get over that, they'll be mad. We're going to need more police."
"More? We've got 18 already, counting the part-timers and the new deputies."
"It won't be enough, and we've got..."
The town whistle began to hammer the air with short blasts. They looked west and saw the smoke rising. "We've got Barbara and Shumway to thank," Big Jim finished.
"Maybe we ought to do something about that fire."
"It's a Tarker's Mills problem, and the U.S. governments, of course. They started a fire with their cotton-picking missile. Let them deal with it."
"But if the heat sparked one on this side..."
"Stop being an old woman and drive me back to town. I've got to find Junior. He and I have things to talk about."
3. Brenda Perkins and the Reverend Piper Libby were in Dipper's parking lot by Piper's Subaru.
"I never thought it would work," Brenda said. "But I'd be a liar if I said I wasn't disappointed."
"Me too," Piper said, bitterly. "I'd offer you a ride back to town, but I have to check on a parishioner."
"Not out on Little Bitch, I hope," Brenda said. She lifted a thumb at the rising smoke.
"No, the other way. Eastchester. Jack Evans. He lost his wife on Dome Day. A freak accident. Not that all of this isn't freakish."
Brenda nodded. "I saw him out at Dinsmore's Field, carrying a sign with his wife's picture on it. Poor, poor man."
Piper went to the open driver's side window of her car where Clover was sitting behind the wheel and watching the departing crowd. She rummaged in her pocket, gave him a treat, then said,
"Push over, Clove. You know you flunked your last driver's test."
To Brenda, she confided, "He can't parallel park worth a damn." The shepherd hopped onto the passenger side. Piper opened the car door and looked at the smoke.
"I'm sure the woods on the Tarker's Mill side are burning briskly, but that needn't concern us."
She gave Brenda a bitter smile.
"We have the dome to protect us." "Good luck," Brenda said. "Give Jack my sympathy and my love."
"I'll do that," Piper said, and drove off. Brenda was walking out of the parking lot with her hands in the pockets of her jeans, wondering how she was going to get through the rest of the day, when Julia Shumway drove up and helped her with that. 4. The missiles exploding against the dome didn't wake Sammy Bushy. It was the clattery wooden crash, followed by little Walter's screams of pain, that did that. Carter Thibodeau and his friends had taken all of her fridge dope when they left, but they hadn't searched the place, so the shoebox with the rough skull and crossbones drawn on it was still in the closet. There was also this message, printed in Phil Bushy's scrawly, backslanting letters, "My shit, touch it, and you die." There was no pot inside. Phil had always sneered at pot as a cocktail party drug, and she had no interest in the baggie of crystal. She was sure the deputies would have enjoyed smoking it, but Sammy thought crystal was crazy shit for crazy people. Who else would inhale smoke that included the residue of matchbook striker pads marinated in acetone? There was another smaller baggie, however, that contained half a dozen dreamboats. And when Carter's posse left, she had swallowed one of these with warm beer from the bottle stashed under the bed she now slept in alone. Except for when she took little Walter in with her, that was. Or Dodie. She had briefly considered taking all of the dreamboats and ending her crappy, unhappy life once and for all. Might even have done it, if not for little Walter. If she died, who would take care of him? He might even starve to death in his crib, a horrible thought. Suicide was out, but she had never felt so depressed and sad and hurt in all her life. Dirty, too. She had been degraded before, God knew, sometimes by Phil, who had enjoyed drug-fueled threesomes before losing interest in sex completely. Sometimes by others, sometimes by herself. Sammy Bushy had never gotten the concept of being her own best friend. Certainly, she'd had her share of one-night stands, and once in high school, after the Wildcats basketball team had won the Class D championship, she had taken on 4 of the starters, one after the other, at a post-game party. The 5th had been passed out in a corner. It had been her own stupid idea. She had also sold what Carter, Mel, and Frankie de Lesseps had taken by force. Most frequently to Freeman Brown, owner of Brownie's store, where she did most of her shopping because Brownie gave her credit. He was old and didn't smell very good, but he was randy, and that was actually a plus. It made him quick. 6 pumps on the mattress in the storeroom was his usual limit, followed by a grunt and a squirt. It was never the highlight of her week, but it was comforting to know that line of credit was there, especially if she came up short at the end of the month and little Walter needed pampers. And Brownie had never hurt her. What had happened last night was different. De Lesseps hadn't been so bad, but Carter had hurt her up top and made her bleed down below. Worse had followed. When Mel Searles dropped his pants, he was sporting a tulle like the ones she'd sometimes seen in the porno movies Phil had watched before his interest in crystal overtook his interest in sex. Searles had gone at her hard, and although she tried to remember what she and Dodie had done 2 days before, it didn't work. She remained as dry as August with no rain. Until, that was, what Carter Thibodeau had only abraded, ripped wide open. Then there was lubrication. She had felt it puddling under her, warm and sticky. There had been wetness on her face, too, tears trickling down her cheeks to nestle in the hollows of her ears. During Mel Searle's endless ride, it came to her that he might actually kill her. If he did, what would happen to little Walter? And weaving through it all, the shrill magpie voice of Georgia Rue. "Do her. Do her. Do that bitch. Make her holler." Sammy had hollered all right. She had hollered plenty. And so had little Walter from his crib in the other room. In the end, they had warned her to keep her mouth shut and left her to bleed on the couch. Hurt, but alive. She'd watched their headlights move across the living room ceiling,
then fade as they drove away toward town. Then it was just her and little Walter. She had walked him back and forth, stopping just once to put on a pair of underpants, not the pink ones, she never wanted to wear those again, and stuff the crotch with toilet paper. She had Tampax, but the thought of putting anything up there made her cringe. Finally, little Walter's head had fallen heavily on her shoulder, and she felt his drool dampening her skin, a reliable sign that he was really and truly out. She had put him back in his crib, praying that he would sleep through the night. And then she had taken the shoebox down from the closet. The dreamboat, some kind of powerful downer, she didn't know exactly what, had first damped the pain down there, and then blotted out everything. She had slept for over 12 hours. Now this. Little Walter's screams were like a bright light cutting through heavy fog. She lurched out of bed and ran into his bedroom, knowing the goddamn crib which Phil had put together half-stoned had finally collapsed. Little Walter had been shaking the shit out of it last night when the deputies were busy with her. That must have weakened it enough so that this morning when he began stirring around, little Walter was on the floor in the wreckage. He crawled toward her with blood pouring from a cut on his forehead. "Little Walter," she screamed, and swept him into her arms. She turned, stumbled over a broken crib slat, went to one knee, got up, and rushed into the bathroom with the baby wailing in her arms. She turned on the water, and of course no water came. There was no power to run the well pump. She grabbed a towel and dry-mopped his face, exposing the cut. Not deep, but long and ragged. It would leave a scar. She pressed the towel against it as hard as she dared, trying to ignore little Walter's renewed shrieks of pain and outrage. Blood pattered onto her bare feet in dime-sized drops. When she looked down, she saw the blue panties she'd put on after the deputies had left were now soaked to a muddy purple. At first, she thought it was little Walter's blood, but her thighs were streaked too. 5. Somehow she got little Walter to hold still long enough to plaster 3 SpongeBob Band-Aids along the gash, and to get him into an undershirt and his one remaining clean overall. On the bib, red stitching proclaimed, "Mommy's Lil Devil." She dressed herself while little Walter crawled in circles on her bedroom floor, his wild sobbing reduced to lackadaisical sniffles. She started by throwing the blood-soaked underpants into the trash and putting on fresh ones. She patted the crotch with a folded dish wiper and took an extra for later. She was still bleeding, not gushing, but it was a far heavier flow than during her worst periods, and it had gone on all night. The bed was soaked. She packed little Walter's go-bag, then picked him up. He was heavy, and she felt fresh pain settle in down there, the sort of throbbing bellyache you got from eating bad food.
"We're going to the health center," she said, "and don't you worry, little Walter. Dr. Haskell will fix us both up. Also, scars don't matter as much to boys. Sometimes girls even think they're sexy. I'll drive as fast as I can, and we'll be there in no time."
She opened the door.
"Everything's gonna be all right."
But her old rust bucket Toyota was far from all right. The deputies hadn't bothered with the back tires, but they had punctured both front ones. Sammy looked at the car for a long moment, feeling an even deeper depression settle over her. An idea, fleeting but clear, crossed her mind. She could split the remaining dreamboats with little Walter. She could grind his up and put them in one of his Playtex nursers, which he called Boggies. She could disguise the taste with chocolate milk. Little Walter loved chocolate milk. Accompanying the idea came the title of one of Phil's old record albums. Nothing matters, and what if it did? She pushed the idea away.
"I'm not that kind of mom," she told little Walter.
He goggled up at her in a way that reminded her of Phil, but in a good way. The expression that only looked like puzzled stupidity on her estranged husband's face was endearingly goofy on her son's. She kissed his nose and he smiled. That was nice, a nice smile. But the band-aids on his forehead were turning red. That wasn't so nice.
"Little change of plan," she said, and went back inside.
At first, she couldn't find the papoose, but finally spotted it behind what she would from now on think of as the rape couch. She finally managed to wriggle little Walter into it, although lifting him hurt her all over again. The dish wiper in her underwear was feeling ominously damp, but when she checked the crotch of her sweatpants, there were no spots. That was good.
"Ready for a walk, little Walter?"
Little Walter only snuggled his cheek into the hollow of her shoulder. Sometimes his paucity of speech bothered her. She had friends whose babies had been babbling whole sentences by 16 months, and little Walter only had 9 or 10 words. But not this morning. This morning she had other things to worry about. The day felt dismayingly warm for the last full week of October. The sky overhead was its very palest shade of blue, and the light was somehow blurry. She felt sweat spring out on her face and neck almost at once, and her crotch was throbbing badly, worse with every step, it seemed, and she had taken only a few. She thought of going back for aspirin, but wasn't it supposed to make bleeding worse? Besides, she wasn't sure she had any. There's something else as well, something she hardly dared admit to herself. If she went back into the house, she wasn't sure she'd have the heart to come back out again. There was a white scrap of paper under the Toyota's left windshield wiper. It had "Just a note from Sammy," printed across the top, and surrounded by daisies, torn from her own kitchen pad. The idea caused a certain tired outrage. Scrawled under the daisies was this: "Tell anyone, and more than your tires will be flat." And below, in another hand, "Next time maybe we'll turn you over and play the other side."
"In your dreams, motherfucker," she said in a wan, tired voice.
She crumpled the note up, dropped it by one flat tire. Poor old Corolla looked almost as tired and sad as she felt, and made her way out to the end of the driveway, pausing to lean against the mailbox for a few seconds. The metal was warm on her skin, the sun hot on her neck, and hardly a breath of breeze. October was supposed to be cool and invigorating.
"Maybe it's that global warming stuff," she thought.
She was first to have this idea, but not the last. And the word which eventually stuck was not global, but local. Motton Road lay before her, deserted and charmless. Starting a mile or so to her left were the nice new homes of Eastchester, to which the mill's higher-class workadaddies and workamommies came at the end of their days in the shops and offices and banks of Lewiston Auburn. To her right lay downtown Chester's Mill and the health center.
"Ready, little Walter?"
Little Walter didn't say if he was or wasn't. He was snoring in the hollow of her shoulder and drooling on her Dawn of the Buffalo t-shirt. Sammy took a deep breath, tried to ignore the throb coming from the land down under, hitched up the papoose, and started toward town. When the whistle started up on top of the town hall, blowing the short blast that indicated a fire, she first thought it was in her own head, which was feeling decidedly weird. Then she saw the smoke, but it was far to the west. Nothing to concern her and little Walter, unless someone came along who wanted a closer look at the fire, that was. If that happened, they would surely be neighborly enough to drop her off at the health center on their way to the excitement. She began to sing the James McMurtry song that had been popular last summer. Got as far as, "We roll up the sidewalks 7:45, it's a small town, can't sell you no beer," then quit. Her mouth was too dry to sing. She blinked and saw she was on the edge of falling into the ditch, and not even the one she'd been walking next to when she started out. She'd woven all the way across the road, an excellent way to get hit instead of picked up. She looked over her shoulder, hoping for traffic. There was none. The road to Eastchester was empty, the tar not quite hot enough to shimmer. She went back to what she thought of as her side, swaying on her feet now, feeling all jelly-legged.
"Drunken sailor," she thought. "What do you do with a drunken sailor early in the morning?"
But it wasn't morning, it was afternoon. She had slept the clock round, and when she looked down, she saw that the crotch of her sweats had turned purple, just like the underpants she'd been wearing earlier.
"That won't come out, and I only have 2 other pairs of sweats that fit me."
Then she remembered one of those had a big old hole in the seat, and began to cry. The tears felt cool on her hot cheeks.
"It's all right, little Walter," she said. "Dr. Haskell's going to fix us up just fine. Fine as paint. Good as..."
Then a black rose began to bloom in front of her eyes, and the last of her strength left her legs.
Sammy felt it go, running out of her muscles like water. She went down, holding onto one final thought. On your side, don't squash the baby. That much she managed. She lay sprawled on the shoulder of Motton Road, unmoving in the hazy July-ish sun. Little Walter awoke and began to cry. He tried to struggle out of the papoose and couldn't. Sammy had snapped him in carefully, and he was pinned. Little Walter began to cry harder. A fly settled on his forehead, sampled the blood oozing through the cartoon images of SpongeBob and Patrick, then flew off, possibly to report this taste treat at Fly HQ and summon reinforcements. Grasshoppers reed in the grass. The town whistle honked. Little Walter, trapped with his unconscious mother, wailed for a while in the heat, then gave up and lay silent, looking around listlessly as sweat rolled out of his fine hair in large, clear drops. 6. Standing beside the Globe Theater's boarded-up box office and under its sagging marquee, the Globe had gone out of business 5 years before, Barbie had a good view of both the town hall and the police station. His good buddy Junior was sitting on the cop shop steps, massaging his temples as if the rhythmic whoop of the whistle hurt his head. Al Timmons came out of the town hall and jogged down to the street. He was wearing his gray janitor's fatigues, but there was a pair of binoculars hanging from a strap around his neck and an Indian pump on his back, empty of water from the ease with which he was carrying it. Barbie guessed Al had blown the fire whistle. "Go away, Al," Barbie thought. "How about it?" Half a dozen trucks rolled up the street. The first two were pickups, the third a panel job. All three lead vehicles were painted a yellow so bright it almost screamed. The pickups had Burpee's department store decaled on the doors. The panel truck's box bore the legendary slogan, "Meet me for Slurpees at Burpee's." Romeo himself was in the lead truck. His hair was its usual daddy cool marvel of sweeps and spirals. Brenda Perkins was riding shotgun. In the pickup's bed were shovels, hoses, and a brand new sump pump still plastered with the manufacturer's stickers. Romeo stopped beside Al Timmons. "Jump in the back, partner," he said, and Al did. Barbie withdrew as far as he could into the shadow of the deserted theater's marquee. He didn't want to be drafted to help fight the fire out on Little Bitch Road. He had business right here in town. Junior hadn't moved from the PD's steps, but he was still rubbing his temples and holding his head. Barbie waited for the trucks to disappear, then hurried across the street. Junior didn't look up, and a moment later he was hidden from Barbie's view by the ivy-covered bulk of the town hall. Barbie went up the steps and paused to read the sign on the message board. "Town meeting Thursday, 7 p.m. if crisis is not resolved." He thought of Julia saying, "Until you've heard Big Jim Rennie's stump speech, don't sell him short." He might get a chance Thursday night. Certainly, Rennie would make his pitch to stay in control of the situation. "And for more power," Julia's voice spoke up in his head. "He'll want that, too, of course. For the good of the town." The town hall had been built of quarried stone 160 years before, and the vestibule was cool and dim. The generator was off. No need to run it with no one here. Except someone was, in the main meeting hall. Barbie heard voices, two of them belonging to children. The tall oak doors were standing ajar. He looked in and saw a skinny man with a lot of graying hair sitting up front at the selectman's table. Opposite him was a pretty little girl of about 10. They had a checkerboard between them. The long hair had his chin propped on one hand, studying his next move. Down below, in the aisle between the benches, a young woman was playing leapfrog with a boy of 4 or 5. The checker players were studious. The young woman and the boy were laughing. Barbie started to withdraw, but too late. The young woman looked up. "Hi, hello?" She picked up the boy and came toward him. The checker players looked up, too, so much for stealth. The young woman was holding out the hand she wasn't using to support the little boy's bottom. "I'm Carolyn Sturges. That gentleman's my friend, Thurston Marshall. The little guy is Aiden Appleton. Say hi, Aiden."
"Hi,"
Aiden said in a small voice, and then plugged his thumb into his mouth. He looked at Barbie with eyes that were round and blue and mildly curious. The girl ran up the aisle to stand beside Carolyn Sturges. The long hair followed more slowly. He looked tired and shaken.
"I'm Alice Rachel Appleton," she said. "Aiden's big sister. Take your thumb out of your mouth, Aid."
Aid didn't. "Well, it's nice to meet all of you," Barbie said. He didn't tell them his own name. In fact, he sort of wished he were wearing a fake mustache. But this still might be all right. He was almost positive these people were out-of-towners.
"Are you a town official?"
Thurston Marshall asked. "If you're a town official, I wish to lodge a complaint." "I'm just the janitor," Barbie said, then remembered they had almost certainly seen Al Timmons leave. Hell probably had a conversation with him. "The other janitor. You must have met Al."
"I want my mother," Aiden Appleton said. "I miss her bad."
"We met him," Carolyn Sturgis said. "He claims the government shot some missiles at whatever is holding us in, and all they did was bounce off and start a fire."
"That's true," Barbie said, and before he could say more, Marshall weighed in again.
"I want to lodge a complaint. In fact, I want to lay a charge. I was assaulted by a so-called police officer. He punched me in the stomach. I had my gallbladder out a few years ago, and I'm afraid I may have internal injuries. Also, Carolyn was verbally abused. She was called a name that degraded her, sexually."
Carolyn laid a hand on his arm.
"Before we go making any charges, Thurs, you want to remember we had D-O-P-E. "Dope," Alice said at once. "Our mom smokes marijuana sometimes because it helps when she's having her P-E-R-I-O-D.
"Oh," Carolyn said. "Right." Her smile was wan. Marshall drew himself up to his full height.
"Possession of marijuana is a misdemeanor," he said. "What they did to me was felony assault, and it hurts. Terribly."
Carolyn gave him a look in which affection was mingled with exasperation. Barbie suddenly understood how it was between them. Sexy May had met erudite November, and now they were stuck with each other, refugees in the New England version of No Exit.
"Thurs, I'm not sure that misdemeanor idea would fly in court."
She smiled apologetically at Barbie.
"We had quite a lot. They took it."
"Maybe they'll smoke up the evidence," Barbie said. She laughed at this. Her graying boyfriend did not. His bushy brows had drawn together.
"All the same, I plan to lodge a complaint."
"I'd wait," Barbie said. "The situation here, well, let's just say that a punch in the gut isn't going to be considered that big a deal as long as we're still under the dome."
"I consider it a big deal, my young janitor friend."
The young woman now looked more exasperated than affectionate.
"Thurs, the good side of that is that nobody's going to make a big deal out of some pot, either," Barbie said.
"Maybe it's a push, as the gamblers say. How'd you come by the kiddos?"
"The cops we ran into at Thurston's cabin saw us at the restaurant," Carolyn said. "The woman who runs it said they were closed until supper, but she took pity on us when we said we were from Massachusetts. She gave us sandwiches and coffee."
"She gave us peanut butter and jelly and coffee," Thurston corrected her. "There was no choice, not even tuna fish. I told her peanut butter sticks to my upper plate, but she said they were on rationing. Isn't that about the craziest thing you've ever heard?"
Barbie did think it was crazy, but since it had also been his idea, he said nothing.
"When I saw the cops come in, I was ready for more trouble," Carolyn said. "But Aid and Alice seemed to have mellowed them out."
Thurston snorted.
"Not so mellow. They apologized, or did I miss that part?"
Carolyn sighed, then turned back to Barbie.
"They said maybe the pastor of the Congregational Church could find the four of us an empty house to live in until this is over. I guess we're going to be foster parents, at least for a while."
She stroked the boy's hair. Thurston Marshall looked less than pleased at the prospect of becoming a foster parent, but he put an arm around the girl's shoulders, and Barbie liked him for that.
"One cop was Junior," Alice said. "He's nice. Also, a fox. Frankie isn't as good-looking, but he was nice, too. He gave us a Milky Way bar. Mom says we're not supposed to take candy from strangers, but..."
She shrugged, to indicate things had changed. A fact she and Carolyn seemed to understand much more clearly than Thurston.
"They weren't nice before," Thurston said. "They weren't nice when they were punching me in the stomach, Carol."
"You have to take the bitter with the sweet," Alice said philosophically. "That's what my mother says."
Carolyn laughed. Barbie joined in, and after a moment, so did Marshall. Although he held his stomach while he did it, and looked at his young girlfriend with a certain reproach. I went up the street and knocked on the church door, Carolyn said. There was no answer, so I went in. The door was unlocked, but there was nobody there. Do you have any idea when the pastor will be back?
Barbie shook his head.
I'd take your checkerboard and go on up to the parsonage if I were you. It's around back. You're looking for a woman named Piper Libby.
Cherchez la femme, Thurston said.
Barbie shrugged, then nodded. She's good people, and God knows there are empty houses in the mill. You could almost have your pick, and you'll probably find supplies in the pantry wherever you go. This made him think of the fallout shelter again. Alice, meanwhile, had grabbed the checkers, which she stuffed in her pockets, and the board, which she carried.
Mr. Marshall's beat me every game so far, she told Barbie. He says it's patronizing to let kids win just because they're kids. But I'm getting better, aren't I, Mr. Marshall?
She smiled up at him. Thurston Marshall smiled back. Barbie thought this unlikely quartet might be okay.
Youth must be served, Alice, my dear, he said, but not immediately.
I want Mommy, Aiden said morosely.
If there was only a way to get in touch with her, Carolyn said. Alice, you're sure you don't remember her email address? And to Barbie she said, Mom left her cell phone at the cabin, so that's no good.
She's a Hotmail, Alice said. That's all I know. Sometimes she says she used to be a hot female, but Daddy took care of that.
Carolyn was looking at her elderly boyfriend. Blow this pop shop?
Yes, we may as well repair to the parsonage, and hope the lady comes back soon from whatever errand of mercy she happens to be on.
Parsonage might be unlocked, too, Barbie said. If it isn't, try under the doormat.
I wouldn't presume, he said.
I would, Carolyn said, and giggled. The sound made the little boy smile.
Presume,
Alice Appleton cried, and went flying up the center aisle with her arms outstretched and the checkerboard flapping from one hand.
Presume, presume, come on, you guys, let's presume.
Thurston sighed and started after her.
If you break the checkerboard, Alice, you'll never beat me.
Yes, I will, 'cause youth must be served, she called back over her shoulder. Besides, we could tape it together, come on.
Aiden wriggled impatiently in Carolyn's arms. She set him down to chase after his sister. Carolyn held out her hand.
Thank you, Mr.
More than welcome, Barbie said, shaking with her. Then he turned to Thurston. The man had the fish belly grip Barbie associated with guys whose intelligence to exercise ratio was out of whack. They started out after the kids. At the double doors, Thurston Marshall looked back. A shaft of hazy sun from one of the high windows struck across his face, making him look older than he was, making him look 80.
I edited the current issue of Plowshares, he said.
His voice quivered with indignation and sorrow.
That is a very good literary magazine, one of the best in the country. They had no right to punch me in the stomach or laugh at me.
No, Barbie said, of course not. Take good care of those kids. We will, Carolyn said. She took the man's arm and squeezed it. Come on, Thurse. Barbie waited until he heard the outer door close, then went in search of the stairs leading to the town hall, conference room, and kitchen. Julia had said the fallout shelter was half a flight down from there. 7. Piper's first thought was that someone had left a bag of garbage beside the road. Then she got a little closer and saw it was a body. She pulled over and scrambled out the car so fast she went to one knee, scraping it. When she got up, she saw it wasn't one body, but two, a woman and a toddler. The child, at least, was alive, waving its arms feebly. She ran to them and turned the woman onto her back. She was young and vaguely familiar, but not a member of Piper's congregation. Her cheek and brow were badly bruised. Piper freed the child from the carrier, and when she held him against her and stroked his sweaty hair, he began to cry hoarsely. The woman's eyes fluttered open at the sound, and Piper saw that her pants were soaked with blood.
Little Walter,
the woman croaked, which Piper misheard. Don't worry, there's water in the car. Lie still. I've got your baby. He's okay. Not knowing if he was or not. I'll take care of him.
Little Walter,
the woman said again, and closed her eyes. Piper ran back to her car with her heart beating hard enough for her to feel it in her eyeballs. Her tongue tasted coppery. God, help me, she prayed. And could think of nothing else, so she thought it again. God, oh God, help me, help that woman. The Subaru had air conditioning, but she hadn't been using it in spite of the heat of the day. Rarely did. Her understanding was that it wasn't very eco-friendly, but she turned it on now, full blast. She laid the baby on the back seat, rolled up the windows, closed the doors, started back toward the young woman lying in the dust, then was struck by a terrible thought. What if the baby managed to climb over the seat, pushed the wrong button, and locked her out?
God, I am so stupid, the worst minister in the world when a real crisis comes. Help me not to be so stupid.
She rushed back, opened the driver's door again, looked over the seat, and saw the boy still lying where she had put him, but now sucking his thumb. His eyes went to her briefly, then looked up at the ceiling as if he saw something interesting there. Mental cartoons, maybe. He had sweated right through the little T-shirt beneath his overall. Piper twisted the electronic key fob back and forth in her fist until it broke free of the key ring. Then she ran back to the woman, who was trying to sit up.
Don't, Piper said, kneeling beside her and putting an arm around her. I don't think you should.
Little Walter,
the woman croaked.
Shit, I forgot the water. God, why did you let me forget the water?
Now the woman was trying to struggle to her feet. Piper didn't like this idea, which ran counter to everything she knew of first aid, but what other option was there? The road was deserted, and she couldn't leave her out in the blaring sun. That would be worse, and more of it. So, instead of pushing her back down, Piper helped her to stand.
Slow, she said, now holding the woman around the waist and guiding her staggering steps as best she could. Slow and easy does it. Slow and easy wins the race. It's cool in the car, and there's water.
Lil Walter...
The woman swayed, steadied, then tried to move a little faster.
Water, Piper said, right. Then I'm taking you to the hospital.
Hell, Sender.
This Piper did understand, and she shook her head firmly. No way. You're going straight to the hospital, you and your baby both.
Lil Walter,
the woman whispered. She stood swaying, head down, hair hanging in her face, while Piper opened the passenger door, and then eased her inside. Piper got the bottle of Poland Spring out of the center console and took off the cap. The woman snatched it from her before Piper could offer it and drank greedily, water overspilling the neck and dripping off her chin to darken the top of her T-shirt.
What's your name? Piper asked.
Sammy Bushy.
And then even as her stomach cramped from the water, that black rose began to open in front of Sammy's eyes again. The bottle dropped out of her hand and fell to the floor mat, gurgling, as she passed out. Piper drove as fast as she could, which was pretty fast, since Motton Road remained deserted. But when she got to the hospital, she discovered that Dr. Haskell had died the day before and the physician's assistant, Everett, was not there. Sammy was examined and admitted by that famed medical expert, Dougie Twitchell. 8. While Ginny was trying to stop Sammy Bushy's vaginal bleeding, and Twitch was giving the badly dehydrated little Walter IV fluids, Rusty Everett was sitting quietly on a park bench at the town hall edge of the common. The bench was beneath the spreading arms of a tall blue spruce, and he thought he was in shade deep enough to render him effectively invisible, as long as he didn't move around much, that was. There were interesting things to look at. He had planned to go directly to the storage building behind the town hall. Twitch had called it a shed, but the long wooden building which also housed the mill's 4 snowplows was actually quite a bit grander than that. And checked the propane situation there, but then one of the police cars pulled up, with Frankie de Lesseps at the wheel. Junior Rennie had emerged from the passenger side. The two had spoken for a moment or two, then de Lesseps had driven away. Junior went up the PD steps. But instead of going in, he sat down there, rubbing his temples as if he had a headache. Rusty decided to wait. He didn't want to be seen checking up on the town's energy supply, especially not by the second selectman's son. At one point, Junior took his cell phone out of his pocket, flipped it open, listened, said something, listened some more, said something else, then flipped it closed again. He went back to rubbing his temples. Dr. Haskell had said something about that young man. Migraine headaches, was it? It certainly looked like a migraine. It wasn't just the temple rubbing. It was the way he was keeping his head down. Trying to minimize the glare, Rusty thought. Must have left his Imitrex or Zomig home. Assuming Haskell prescribed it, that is. Rusty had half-risen, meaning to cut across Commonwealth Lane to the rear of the town hall, Junior clearly not being at his most observant. But then he spotted someone else and sat down again. Dale Barbara, the short-order cook who had reputedly been elevated to the rank of colonel, by the president himself, according to some, was standing beneath the marquee of the Globe, even deeper in the shadows than Rusty was himself. And Barbara also appeared to be keeping an eye on young Mr. Rennie. Interesting. Barbara apparently came to the conclusion that Rusty had already drawn. Junior wasn't watching, but waiting, possibly for someone to pick him up. Barbara hustled across the street and, once he was blocked from Junior's potential view by the town hall itself, paused to scan the message board out front. Then he went inside. Rusty decided to sit where he was a while longer. It was nice under the tree, and he was curious about whom Junior might be waiting for. People were still straggling back from Dippers. Some would have stayed much longer had the booze been flowing. Most of them, like the young man sitting on the steps over yonder, had their heads down, not in pain, Rusty surmised, but in dejection. Or maybe they were the same. It was certainly a point to ponder. Now here came a boxy black gas gobbler Rusty knew well. Big Jim Rennie's Hummer. It honked impatiently at a trio of townsfolk who were walking in the street, shunting them aside like sheep. The Hummer pulled in at the PD. Junior looked up but didn't stand up. The doors opened. Andy Sanders got out from behind the wheel, Rennie from the passenger side. Rennie, allowing Sanders to drive his beloved Black Pearl? Sitting on his bench, Rusty raised his eyebrows. He didn't think he'd ever seen anyone but Big Jim himself behind the wheel of that monstrosity. Maybe he's decided to promote Andy from dog's body to chauffeur, he thought. But when he watched Big Jim mount the steps to where his son still sat, he changed his mind. Like most veteran medicos, Rusty was a pretty fair long-distance diagnostician. He would never have based a course of treatment on it, but you could tell a man who'd had a hip replacement 6 months ago from one currently suffering with hemorrhoids simply by the way he walked. You could tell a neck strain by the way a woman would turn her whole body instead of just looking back over her shoulder. You could tell a kid who'd picked up a good crop of lice at summer camp by the way he kept scratching his head. Big Jim held his arm against the upper slope of his considerable gut as he went up the steps. The classic body language of a man who has recently suffered either a shoulder strain, an upper arm strain, or both. Not so surprising that Sanders had been delegated to pilot the beast after all. The three of them talked. Junior didn't get up, but Sanders sat down beside him, rummaged in his pocket, and brought out something that twinkled in the hazy afternoon sunlight. Rusty's eyes were good, but he was at least 50 yards too far away to make out what the object might have been. Either glass or metal. That was all he could tell for sure. Junior put it in his pocket, then the three of them talked some more. Rennie gestured to the Hummer. He did it with his good arm, and Junior shook his head. Then Sanders pointed to the Hummer. Junior declined it again, dropped his head, and went back to working his temples. The two men looked at each other, Sanders craning his neck because he was still sitting on the steps, and in Big Jim's shadow, which Rusty thought appropriate. Big Jim shrugged and opened his hands, a what-can-you-do gesture. Sanders stood up and the two men went into the PD building, Big Jim pausing long enough to pat his son's shoulder. Junior gave no response to that. He went on sitting where he was, as if he intended to sit out the age. Sanders played doorman for Big Jim, ushering him inside before following. The two selectmen had no more than left the scene when a quartet came out of the town hall. An oldish gent, a young woman, a girl, and a boy. The girl was holding the boy's hand and carrying a checkerboard. The boy looked almost as disconsolate as Junior, Rusty thought, and damned if he wasn't also rubbing one temple with his free hand. The four of them cut across Calm Lane, then passed directly in front of Rusty's bench.
"Hello," the little girl said brightly. "I'm Alice. This is Aiden.
We're going to live at the Passionage,"
the little boy named Aiden said dourly. He was still rubbing his temple, and he looked very pale. "That will be exciting," Rusty said. "Sometimes I wish I lived at a passenage." The man and woman caught up with the kids. They were holding hands.
Father and daughter, Rusty surmised. Actually, we just want to talk to the Reverend Libby, the woman said. You wouldn't know if she's back yet, would you?
No idea, Rusty said.
Well, we'll just go over and wait. At the Passionage. She smiled up at the older man when she said this.
Rusty decided they might not be father and daughter, after all.
That's what the janitor said to do.
Al Timmons? Rusty had seen Al hop into the back of a Burpee's department store truck.
No, the other one, the older man said. He said the Reverend might be able to help us with lodgings.
Rusty nodded.
Was his name Dale? I don't think he actually gave us his name, the woman said.
Come on!
The boy let go of his sister's hand and tugged at the woman's instead.
I want to play that other game you said.
But he sounded more querulous than eager. Mild shock, maybe, or some physical ailment. If the latter, Rusty hoped it was only a cold. The last thing the mill needed right now was an outbreak of flu.
They've misplaced their mother, at least temporarily, the woman said in a low voice. We're taking care of them.
Good for you, Rusty said, and meant it. Son, does your head hurt?
No.
Sore throat?
No,
the boy named Aiden said. His solemn eyes studied Rusty.
Know what? If we don't trick-or-treat this year, I don't even care.
Aiden Appleton, Alice cried, sounding shocked out of her shoes.
Rusty jerked a little on the bench. He couldn't help it. Then he smiled.
No? Why is that?
Because Mommy takes us around and Mommy went for supplies.
He means supplies, the girl named Alice said indulgently.
She went for whoops,
Aiden said. He looked like a little old man. A little old worried man.
I'd be scared to go Halloweenin' without Mommy.
Come on, Carol, the man said.
We ought to...
Rusty rose from the bench. Could I speak to you for a minute, ma'am? Just a step or two over here. Carol looked puzzled and wary, but stepped with him to the side of the blue spruce. Has the boy exhibited any seizure activity? Rusty asked. That might include suddenly stopping what he's doing, you know, just standing still for a while, or a fixed stare, smacking of the lips.
Nothing like that, the man said, joining them.
No, Caro agreed, but she looked frightened. The man saw it and turned an impressive frown on Rusty.
Are you a doctor?
Physician's assistant, I thought maybe...
Well, I'm sure we appreciate your concern, Mr...
Eric Everett, call me Rusty.
We appreciate your concern, Mr. Everett, but I believe it's misplaced. Bear in mind that these children are without their mother.
And they spent two nights alone without much to eat, Caro added. They were trying to make it to town on their own when those two... Officers, she wrinkled her nose as if the word had a bad smell, found them. Rusty nodded.
That could explain it, I guess. Although the little girl seems fine. Children react differently, and we better go. They're getting away from us, Thurse. Alice and Aiden were running across the park, kicking up colorful bursts of fallen leaves, Alice flapping the checkerboard and yelling, "Passionage, passionage," at the top of her lungs. The boy was keeping up with her stride for stride and also yelling. Kid had a momentary fugue, that's all, Rusty thought. The rest was coincidence, not even that. What American kid isn't thinking of Halloween during the last half of October? One thing was sure. If these people were asked later, they would remember exactly where and when they had seen Eric Rusty Everett. So much for stealth. The gray-haired man raised his voice.
Children, slow down!
The young woman considered Rusty, then put out her hand.
Thank you for your concern, Mr. Everett. Rusty.
Probably over-concern, occupational hazard. You're totally forgiven. This has been the craziest weekend in the history of the world. Chalk it up to that.
You bet. And if you need me, check the hospital or the health center.
He pointed in the direction of Kathy Russell, which would be visible through the trees once the rest of the leaves fell. If they fell.
Or this bench, she said, still smiling.
Or this bench.
Right. Also smiling.
Caro!
Thurse sounded impatient. Come on! She gave Rusty a little wave, no more than a twiddle of the fingertips, then ran after the others. She ran lightly, gracefully. Rusty wondered if Thurse knew that girls who could run lightly and gracefully.
almost always ran away from their elderly lovers sooner or later. Maybe he did. Maybe it had happened to him before. Rusty watched them cut across the common toward the spire of the Congo Church. Eventually the trees screened them from sight. When he looked back at the PD building, Junior Rennie was gone. Rusty sat where he was for a moment or two, drumming his fingers on his thighs. Then he came to a decision and stood up, checking the town storage shed for the hospital's missing propane tanks could wait. He was more curious about what the mill's one and only army officer was doing in the town hall. 9. What Barbie was doing as Rusty crossed Calm Lane to the town hall was whistling appreciatively through his teeth. The fallout shelter was as long as an Amtrak dining car, and the shelves were fully stocked with canned goods. Most looked pretty fishy. Stacks of sardines, ranks of salmon, and a lot of something called Snow's Clam Fryettes, which Barbie sincerely hoped he would never have to sample. There were boxes of dry goods, including many large plastic canisters marked rice, wheat, powdered milk, and sugar. There were stacked flats of bottles labeled drinking water. He counted 10 large cartons of U.S. government surplus crackers. 2 more were labeled U.S. government surplus chocolate bars. On the wall above these was a yellowing sign reading, 700 calories a day keeps hunger at bay. Dream on, Barbie muttered. There was a door at the far end. He opened it on Stygian blackness, felt around, found a light switch. Another room, not quite so big, but still large. It looked old and disused, not dirty. Al Timmons at least must know about it, because someone had been dusting the shelves and dry-mopping the floors. But neglected, for sure. The stored water was in glass bottles, and he hadn't seen any of those since a brief stint in Saudi. This second room contained a dozen folded cots, plus plain blue blankets and mattresses that had been zipped into clear plastic covers, pending use. There were more supplies, including half a dozen cardboard canisters labeled sanitation kit, and another dozen marked air masks. There was a small auxiliary generator that could supply minimal power. It was running. Must have started up when he turned on the lights. Flanking the little Jenny were 2 shelves. On one was a radio that looked as if it might have been new around the time C.W. McCall's novelty song Convoy had been a hit. On the other shelf were 2 hot plates and a metal box painted bright yellow. The logo on the side was from the days when CD stood for something other than compact disc. It was what he had come to find. Barbie picked it up, then almost dropped it. It was heavy. On the front was a gauge labeled counts per second. When you turned the instrument on and pointed the sensor at something, the needle might stay in the green, rise to the yellow center of the dial, or go over into the red. That, Barbie assumed, would not be good. He turned it on. The little power lamp stayed dark, and the needle lay quiet against zero. "Battery's dead," someone said from behind him. Barbie almost jumped out of his skin. He looked around and saw a tall, heavy-set man with blonde hair standing in the doorway between the 2 rooms. For a moment, the name eluded him, although the guy was at the restaurant most Sunday mornings, sometimes with his wife, always with his 2 little girls. Then it came to him. "Rusty Evers, right?" "Close. It's Everett." The newcomer held out his hand. A little warily, Barbie walked over and shook it. "Saw you come in, and that," he nodded to the Geiger counter, "is probably not a bad idea. Something must be keeping it in place." He didn't say what he meant by "it," and didn't need to. "Glad you approve. You almost scared me into a goddamn heart attack. But you could take care of that, I guess. You're a doc, right?" "PA," Rusty said. "That means..." "I know what it means." "Okay, you win the waterless cookware." Rusty pointed at the Geiger counter. "That thing probably takes a 6-volt dry cell. I'm pretty sure I saw some at Burpee's. Less sure anybody's there right now, so... maybe a little more recce?" "What exactly would we be reconning?" "The supply shed out back." "And we'd want to do that because..." "That depends on what we find. If it's what we lost up at the hospital, you and I might exchange a little information." "Want to share on what you lost?" propane, brother. Barbie considered this. What the hell? Let's take a look. 10. Junior stood at the foot of the rickety stairs leading up the side of Sanders' hometown drug, wondering if he could possibly climb them with his head aching the way it was. Maybe. Probably. On the other hand, he thought he might get halfway up and his skull would pop like a New Year's Eve noisemaker. The spot was back in front of his eye, jigging and jagging with his heartbeat. But it was no longer white. It had turned bright red. I'd be okay, in the dark, he thought, in the pantry, with my girlfriends. If this went right, he could go there. Right now, the pantry of the McCain house on Prestille Street seemed like the most desirable place on earth. Of course, Coggins was there too, but so what? Junior could always push that gospel-shouting asshole to one side. And Coggins had to stay hidden, at least for the time being. Junior had no interest in protecting his father, and was neither surprised nor dismayed at what his old man had done. Junior had always known Big Jim Rennie had murder in him. But he did have an interest in fixing Dale Barbara's little red wagon. If we handle this right, we can do more than get him out of the way, Big Jim had said that morning. We can use him to unify the town in the face of this crisis. And that cotton-picking newspaper woman. I have an idea about her, too. He had laid a warm and hammy hand on his son's shoulder. We're a team, son. Maybe not forever, but for the time being, they were pulling the same plow. And they would take care of Barbie. It had even occurred to Junior that Barbie was responsible for his headaches. If Barbie really had been overseas, Iraq was the rumor, then he might have come home with some weird Middle Eastern souvenirs. Poison, for instance. Junior had eaten in Sweetbriar Rose many times. Barbara could easily have dropped a little something-something in his food. Or his coffee. And if Barbie wasn't working the grill personally, he could have gotten Rose to do it. That cunt was under his spell. Junior mounted the stairs, walking slowly, pausing every four steps. His head didn't explode. And when he reached the top, he groped in his pocket for the apartment key Andy Sanders had given him. At first he couldn't find it and thought he might have lost it, but at last his fingers came upon it, hiding under some loose change. He glanced around. A few people were still walking back from Dippers, but no one looked at him up here on the landing outside Barbie's apartment. The key turned in the lock, and he slipped inside. He didn't turn on the lights, although Sanders' generator was probably sending juice to the apartment. The dimness made the pulsing spot in front of his eye less visible. He looked around curiously. There were books, shelves and shelves of them. Had Barbie been planning on leaving them behind when he blew town? Or had he made arrangements, possibly with Petra Searles, who worked downstairs, to ship them someplace? If so, he'd probably made similar arrangements to ship the rug on the living room floor. Some camel jockey-looking artifact Barbie had probably picked up in the local bazaar when there were no suspects to waterboard or little boys to bugger. He hadn't made arrangements to have the stuff shipped, Junior decided. He hadn't needed to, because he had never planned to leave at all. Once the idea occurred, Junior wondered why he hadn't seen it before. Barbie liked it here. Would never leave of his own free will. He was as happy as a maggot in dog puke. Find something he can't talk away, Big Jim had instructed. Something that can only be his, do you understand me? What do you think I am, Dad, stupid? Junior thought now. If I'm stupid, how come it was me who saved your ass last night? But his father had a mighty swing on him when he got his mat on, that much was undeniable. He had never slapped or spanked Junior as a child, something Junior had always attributed to his late mother's ameliorating influence. Now he suspected it was because his father understood, deep in his heart, that once he started he might not be able to stop. Like father, like son, Junior said, and giggled. It hurt his head, but he giggled anyway. What was that old saying about laughter being the best medicine? He went into Barbie's bedroom, saw the bed was neatly made, and thought briefly of how wonderful it would be to take a big shit right in the middle of it. Yes, and then wipe himself with the pillowcase. How would you like that, Barbie? He went to the dresser instead. Three or four pairs of jeans in the top drawer, plus two pairs of khaki shorts.
Under the shorts was his cell phone, and for a moment he thought that was what he wanted. But no. It was a discount store special, what the kids at college called a burner, or a throwaway. Barbie could always say it wasn't his. There were half a dozen pairs of skivvies and another four or five pairs of plain white athletic socks in the second drawer. Nothing at all in the third drawer. He looked under the bed, his head thudding and whamming. Not better after all, it seemed. And nothing under there, not even dust kitties. Barbie was a neat nick. Junior considered taking the Imitrex in his watch pocket, but didn't. He'd taken two already with absolutely no effect except for the metallic aftertaste in the back of his throat. He knew what medicine he needed. The dark pantry on Prestile Street. And the company of his girlfriends. Meantime, he was here. And there had to be something. Something, he whispered. Gotta have a little something-something. He started back to the living room, wiping water from the corner of his throbbing left eye, not noticing it was tinged with blood. Then stopped, struck by an idea. He returned to the dresser, opened the sock and underwear drawer again. The socks were bald. When he was in high school, Junior had sometimes hidden a little weed or a couple of uppers in his balled-up socks. Once, one of Adriat Nadeau's thongs. Socks were a good hiding place. He took out the neatly made bundles one at a time, feeling them up. He hit pay dirt on the third ball, something that felt like a flat piece of metal. No, two of them. He unrolled the socks and shook the heavy one over the top of the dresser. What fell out were Dale Barbara's dog tags. And in spite of his terrible headache, Junior smiled. In the frame, Barbie, he thought. You are in the fucking frame. 11. On the Tarker's Mill side of Little Bitch Road, the fires set by the Fast Hawk missiles were still raging, but would be out by dark. Fire departments from four towns, augmented by a mixed detachment of Marine and Army grunts, were working on it, and gaining. It would have been out even sooner, Brenda Perkins judged, if the firefighters over there hadn't had a brisk wind to contend with. On the mill side, they'd had no such problem. It was a blessing today. Later on, it might be a curse. There was no way to know. Brenda wasn't going to let the question bother her this afternoon because she felt good. If someone had asked her this morning when she thought she might feel good again, Brenda would have said maybe next year, maybe never. And she was wise enough to know this feeling probably wouldn't last. 90 minutes of hard exercise had a lot to do with it. Exercise released endorphins, whether the exercise was jogging or pounding out brush fires with the flat of a spade. But this was more than endorphins. It was being in charge of a job that was important, one that she could do. Other volunteers had come to the smoke. 14 men and 3 women stood on either side of Little Bitch, some still holding the spades and rubber mats they'd been using to put out the creeping flames, some with the Indian pumps they'd been wearing on their backs, now unslung and sitting on the unpaved hardpack of the road. Al Timmons, Johnny Carver, and Nell Toomey were coiling hoses and tossing them into the back of the burpees truck. Tommy Anderson from Dippers and Lissa Jameson, a little new agey but also as strong as a horse, were carrying the sump pump they'd used to draw water from Little Bitch Creek to one of the other trucks. Brenda heard laughter and realized she wasn't the only one currently enjoying an endorphin rush. The brush on both sides of the road was blackened and still smoldering, and several trees had gone up, but that was all. The dome had blocked the wind and had helped them in another way as well, partially damming the creek and turning the area on this side into a marsh in progress. The fire on the other side was a different story. The men fighting it over there were shimmering wraiths, seen through the heat and accumulating soot on the dome. Romeo Burpee sauntered up to her. He was holding a soaked broom in one hand and a rubber floor mat in the other. The price tag was still clinging to the underside of the mat. The words on it were charred but readable. Every day is sale day at Burpee's. He dropped it and stuck out a grimy hand. Brenda was surprised, but willing. She shook firmly. "What's that for, Romy?" "For you doing one damn fine job out here," he said. She laughed, embarrassed but pleased. "Anybody could have done it, given the conditions. It was only a contact fire, and the ground's so squelchy it probably would have put itself out by sunset." "Maybe," he said, then pointed through the trees to a raggedy clearing with a tumble-down rock wall meandering across it.
Or maybe it would have gotten into that high grass, then the trees on the other side, and then Katie bar the door. It could have burned for a week or a month, especially with no damn fire department. He turned his head aside and spat. Even without wind, a fire will burn if it gets a foothold. They got mine fires down south that have burned for 20-30 years. I read it in National Geographic. No wind underground. And how do we know a good wind won't come up? We don't know jack about what that thing does or don't do. They both looked toward the dome. The soot and ash had rendered it visible, sort of, to a height of almost 100 feet. It had also dimmed their view of the Tarker's side, and Brenda didn't like that. It wasn't anything she wanted to consider deeply. Not when it might rob some of her good feelings about the afternoon's work, but no. She didn't like it at all. It made her think of last night's weird, smeary sunset. Dale Barbara needs to call his friend in Washington, she said. Tell him, when they get the fire out on their side, they have to hose that whatever it is off. We can't do it from our side. Good idea, Romeo said, but something else was on his mind. Do you recognize anything about your crew, ma'am? Because I sure do. Brenda looked startled. They're not my crew. Oh, yes, they are, he said. You were the one given orders, that makes them your crew. You see any cops? She took a look. Not a one, Romeo said. Not Randolph, not Henry Morrison, not Freddie Denton or Rupe Libby, not Georgie Frederick. None of the new ones, either. Those kids. They're probably busy with... She trailed off. Romeo nodded. Right. Busy with what? You don't know, and neither do I. But whatever they're busy with, I'm not sure I like it. Or think it's worth being busy with. There's going to be a town meeting Thursday night, and if this is still going on, I think there should be some changes. He paused. I could be getting out of my place here, but I think maybe you ought to stand for Chief of Fire and Police. Brenda considered it. Considered the file she had found marked Vader. Then shook her head slowly. It's too soon for anything like that. What about just fire, Chief? How about that one? The Lewiston on Parle coming on stronger in his voice now. Brenda looked around at the smoldering brush and charred trashwood trees. Ugly, granted, like something out of a World War I battlefield photo, but no longer dangerous. The people who had shown up here had seen to that. The crew. Her crew. She smiled. That I might consider. 12. The first time Ginny Tomlinson came down the hospital hallway, she was running, responding to a loud beeping that sounded like bad news. And Piper didn't have a chance to speak to her. Didn't even try. She had been in the waiting room long enough to get the picture. Three people, two nurses, and a teenage candy striper named Gina Buffalino, in charge of an entire hospital. They were coping, but barely. When Ginny came back, she was walking slowly. Her shoulders were slumped. A medical chart dangled from one hand. Ginny? Piper asked. Okay. Piper thought Ginny might snap at her, but she offered a tired smile instead of a snarl, and sat down next to her. Fine, just tired. She paused. Also, Ed Carty just died. Piper took her hand. I am very sorry to hear that. Ginny squeezed her fingers. Don't be. You know how women talk about having babies? This one had an easy delivery. This one had it hard. Piper nodded. Death is like that, too. Mr. Carty was in labor a long time. But now he's delivered. To Piper, the idea seemed beautiful. She thought she could use it in a sermon. Except she guessed that people wouldn't want to hear a sermon on death this coming Sunday. Not if the dome was still in place. They sat for a while, Piper trying to think of the best way to ask what she had to ask. In the end, she didn't have to. She was raped, Ginny said. Probably more than once. I was afraid Twitch was going to have to try his suturing, but I finally got it stopped with a vaginal pack. She paused. I was crying.
Luckily, the girl was too stoned to notice.
And the baby?
Your basic healthy 18-month-old, but he gave us a scare. He had a mini-seizure. There was probably exposure to the sun. Plus dehydration, hunger, and he has a wound of his own.
Ginny traced a line across her forehead. Twitch came down the hall and joined them. He looked light years from his usual jaunty self.
Did the men who raped her also hurt the baby?
Piper's voice remained calm, but a thin red fissure was opening in her mind. Little Walter?
I think he just fell, Twitch said. Sammy said something about the crib collapsing. It wasn't completely coherent, but I'm pretty sure it was an accident. That part, anyway.
Piper was looking at him, bemused.
That was what she was saying. I thought it was little water. I'm sure she wanted water, Ginny said, but Sammy's baby really is little. First name, Walter. Second name. They named him after a blues harmonica player, I believe. She and Phil.
Ginny mimed sucking a joint and holding in the smoke.
Oh, Phil was a lot more than a smoke hound, Twitch said. When it came to drugs, Phil Bushy was a multitasker.
Is he dead? Piper asked.
Twitch shrugged.
I haven't seen him around since spring. If he is, good riddance.
Piper looked at him reproachfully. Twitch ducked his head a little.
Sorry, Rev.
He turned to Ginny. Any sign of Rusty?
He needed some time off, she said, and I told him to go. He'll be back soon, I'm sure.
Piper sat between them, outwardly calm. Inside, the red fissure was widening. There was a sour taste in her mouth. She remembered a night when her father had forbidden her to go out to skate scene at the mall because she'd said something smart to her mother. As a teenager, Piper Libby had been an absolute font of smart things to say. She'd gone upstairs, called the friend she had expected to meet, and told that friend, in a perfectly pleasant, perfectly even voice, that something had come up and she wouldn't be able to meet her after all. Next weekend? For sure. Uh-huh, you bet. Have a good time. No, I'm fine. Bye-bye. Then she had trashed her room. She finished by yanking her beloved Oasis poster off the wall and tearing it up. By then she had been crying hoarsely, not in sorrow, but in one of those rages that had blown through her teenage years like Force 5 hurricanes. Her father came up at some point during the festivities and stood in the doorway regarding her. When she finally saw him there, she stared back defiantly, panting, thinking how much she hated him, how much she hated them both. If they were dead, she could go live with her Aunt Ruth in New York. Aunt Ruth knew how to have a good time. Not like some people. He had held his hands out to her, open, extended. It had been a somehow humble gesture, one that had crushed her anger and almost crushed her heart.
If you don't control your temper will control you, he had said, and then left her, walking down the hallway with his head bent. She hadn't slammed the door behind him.
She had closed it, very quietly. That was the year she had made her often vile temper her number one priority. Killing it completely would be killing part of herself, but she thought that if she did not make some fundamental changes, an important part of her would remain 15 for a long, long time. She had begun working to impose control, and mostly she had succeeded. When she felt that control slipping, she would remember what her father had said, and that open-handed gesture, and his slow walk along the upstairs hall of the house she had grown up in. She had spoken at his funeral service 9 years later, saying, "My father told me the most important thing I've ever heard." She hadn't said what that thing was, but her mother had known. She had been sitting in the front pew of the church in which her daughter was now ordained.
For the last 20 years, when she felt the urge to flash out at someone, and often the urge was nearly uncontrollable because people could be so stupid, so willfully dumb, she would summon her father's voice. "If you don't control your temper will control you." But now the red fissure was widening, and she felt the old urge to throw things, to scratch skin until the blood came sweating out.
"Did you ask her who did it?"
"Yes, of course," Ginny said. "She won't say. She's scared." Piper remembered how she'd first thought the mother and baby lying beside the road was a bag of garbage. And that, of course, was what they'd been to whoever did this. She stood up.
"I'm going to talk to her." "That might not be such a good idea right now," Ginny said. "She's had a sedative and..."
"Let her take her shot," Twitch said. His face was pale, his hands were knotted between his knees. The knuckles cracked repeatedly. And make it a good one, Rev. 13. Sammy's eyes were at half-mast. They opened slowly when Piper sat down beside her bed.
You were the one who...
Yes, Piper said, taking her hand. My name is Piper Libby.
Thank you,
Sammy said. Her eyes began to drift closed again.
Thank me by telling me the names of the men who raped you.
In the dim room, warm with the hospital's air conditioning shut down, Sammy shook her head.
They said they'd hurt me if I told.
She glanced at Piper. It was a cow-like glance full of dumb resignation.
They might hurt little Walter, too.
Piper nodded.
I understand you're frightened, she said. Now, tell me who they were. Give me the names. Didn't you hear me?
Looking away from Piper now.
They said they would hurt.
Piper had no time for this. The girl would zone out on her. She grabbed Sammy's wrist.
I want those names, and you're going to give them to me. I don't dare.
Sammy began to ooze tears.
You're going to do it, because if I hadn't come along, you might be dead now.
She paused, then drove the dagger the rest of the way in. She might regret it later, but not now. Right now, the girl in the bed was only an obstacle standing between her and what she needed to know.
Not to mention your baby. He might be dead, too. I saved your life, I saved his, and I want those names. No.
But the girl was weakening now, and part of the Reverend Piper Libby was actually enjoying this. Later she'd be disgusted. Later she'd think, you're not that much different from those boys. Forcing is forcing. But now, yes, there was pleasure, just as there had been pleasure in tearing the treasured poster from the wall and ripping it to shreds.
I like it because it is bitter, she thought, and because it is my heart.
She leaned over the crying girl.
Dig the wax out of your ears, Sammy, because you need to hear this. What they've done once, they'll do again. And when they do, when some other woman shows up here with a bloody snatch and possibly pregnant with a rapist child, I will come to you and I will say, no, stop.
You were part of it. You were right there, cheering them on.
No, Sammy cried. Not me. That was Georgia. Georgia was the one cheering them on.
Piper felt cold disgust. A woman. A woman had been there. In her head, the red fissure opened wider. Soon, it would begin to spew lava.
Give me the names, she said. And Sammy did.
14. Jackie Weddington and Linda Everett were parked outside Food City. It was closing at 5 p.m. instead of 8. Randolph had sent them there, thinking the early closing might cause trouble. A ridiculous idea, because the supermarket was almost empty. There were hardly a dozen cars in the parking lot, and the few remaining shoppers were moving in a slow daze, as if sharing the same bad dream. The two officers saw only one cashier, a teenager named Bruce Yardley. The kid was taking currency and writing chits instead of running credit cards. The meat counter was looking depleted, but there was still plenty of chicken, and most of the canned and dry goods shelves were fully stocked. They were waiting for the last customers to leave when Linda's cell phone rang. She looked at the caller ID and felt a little stab of fear in her stomach. It was Marta Edmonds, who kept Janelle and Judy when Linda and Rusty were both working, as they had been almost nonstop since the dome came down. She hit callback.
Marta?
She said, praying it was nothing. Marta asking if it was okay for her to take the girls down to the common, something like that.
Everything all right? Well, yes, that is, I guess so.
Linda hating the worry she heard in Marta's voice.
But you know that seizure thing? Oh, God, did she have one? I think so, Marta said, then hurried on. They're perfectly okay now, in the other room, coloring. What happened, tell me. They were on the swings. I was doing my flowers, getting them ready for winter.
Marta, please, Linda said, and Jackie laid a hand on her arm.
I'm sorry. Audie started to bark, so I turned around. I said, honey, you all right? She didn't answer, just got out of the swing and sat down underneath, you know, where there's a little dip from all the feet. She didn't fall out or anything, just sat down.
She was staring straight ahead and doing that lip-smacking thing you told me to watch for. I ran over, kind of shook her, and she said, let me think.
Here it comes, Linda thought. Stop Halloween. You have to stop Halloween. But no, it was something else entirely.
She said, the pink stars are falling, the pink stars are falling in lines. Then she said, it's so dark and everything smells bad. Then she woke up and now everything's fine. Thank God for that, Linda said, and spared a thought for her 5-year-old. Is Judy okay? Did it upset her?
There was a long pause on the line, and then Marta said,
oh.
Oh, what does that mean, oh?
It was Judy, Linda. Not Janelle. This time it was Judy.
15. I want to play that other game you said, Aiden had told Carolyn Sturges when they had stopped on the common to talk to Rusty. The other game she had in mind was Red Light, although Carolyn had only the slightest recollection of the rules. Not surprising, since she hadn't played it since she was 6 or 7. But once she was standing against a tree in the commodious backyard of the Passionage, the rules came back to her, and unexpectedly to Thurston, who seemed not only willing to play but eager. Remember, he instructed the children, who somehow seemed to have missed the pleasures of Red Light themselves. She can count to 10 as fast as she wants to, and if she catches you moving when she turns around, you have to go all the way back.
She won't catch me, Alice said.
Me either, Aiden said stoutly.
We'll see about that, Carolyn said, and turned her face to the tree. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, Red Light.
She whirled around. Alice was standing with a smile on her mouth and one leg extended in a big old giant step. Thurston, also smiling, had his hands extended in Phantom of the Opera claws. She caught the slightest movement from Aiden, but didn't even think about sending him back. He looked happy, and she had no intention of spoiling that.
Good, she said. Good little statues. Here comes round 2.
She turned to the tree and counted again, invaded by the old, childishly delicious fear of knowing people were moving in while her back was turned.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, red light!
She whirled. Alice was now only 20 paces away. Aiden was 10 paces or so behind her, trembling on one foot, a scab on his knee very visible. Thirst was behind the boy, one hand on his chest, like an orator, smiling. Alice was going to be the one to catch her, but that was all right. In the second game, the girl would be it, and her brother would win. She and Thirst would see to it. She turned to the tree again.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Then Alice screamed. Carolyn turned and saw Aiden Appleton lying on the ground. At first she thought he was still trying to play the game. One knee, the one with the scab on it, was up, as if he were trying to run on his back. His wide eyes were staring at the sky. His lips were folded into a poochy little O. There was a dark spot spreading on his shorts. She rushed to him.
What's wrong with him? Alice asked.
Carolyn could see all the stress of the terrible weekend crushing in on her face.
Is he all right?
Aiden? Thurst asked. You okay, big fella?
Aiden went on trembling, his lips seeming to suck at an invisible straw. His bent leg came down, then kicked out. His shoulders twitched. He's having some kind of seizure, Carolyn said, probably from overexcitement. I think he'll come out of it if we just give him a few
The pig stars are falling, Aiden said. They make lines behind them. It's pretty. It's scary. Everyone is watching. No treats, only tricks. Hard to breathe. He calls himself the chef. It's his fault. He's the one.
Carolyn and Thurston looked at each other. Alice was kneeling by her brother, holding his hand.
Pink stars, Aiden said. They fall, they fall, they Wake up! Alice shouted into his face. Stop scaring us!
Thurston Marshall touched her shoulder gently.
Honey, I don't think that's helping.
Alice paid him no mind.
Wake up, you crap head!
And Aiden did. He looked at his sister's tear-streaked face, puzzled. Then he looked at Carolyn and smiled. The sweetest goddamn smile she had ever seen in her life.
Did I win?
He asked. 16. The Jenny in the town hall supply shed was badly maintained. Someone had shoved an old-timey galvanized tin wash basin under it to catch the dripping oil. and Rusty guessed about as energy efficient as Big Jim Rennie's Hummer, but he was more interested in the silver tank attached to it. Barbie looked briefly at the generator, grimaced at the smell, then moved to the tank. "It isn't as big as I would have expected," he said, although it was a hell of a lot bigger than the canisters they used at Sweetbriar, or the one he had changed out for Brenda Perkins. "It's called municipal size," Rusty said. "I remember that from the town meeting last year. Sanders and Rennie made a big deal of how the smaller tanks were going to save us yay bucks during these times of costly energy. Each one holds 800 gallons. "Which means a weight of, what, 6,400 pounds? Rusty nodded. "Plus the weight of the tank. It's a lot to lift. You'd need a forklift or a hydraulic power step, but not to move. A Ram pickup is rated for 6,800 pounds, and it could probably carry more. One of these mid-sized tanks would fit in the bed, too. Sticking out the end a little bit is all." Rusty shrugged. "Hang a red flag from it, and you're good to go." "This is the only one here," Barbie said. "When it's gone, the town hall lights go out." "Unless Rennie and Sanders know where there are more," Rusty agreed. "And I'm betting they do." Barbie ran a hand over the blue stenciling on the tank. CRHOSP. "This is what you lost?" "We didn't lose it. It was stolen. That's what I'm thinking. Only there should be 5 more of our tanks in here, because we're missing a total of 6. Barbie surveyed the long shed. Despite the stored plows and cartons of reserve parts, the place looked empty, especially around the generator. "Never mind what got kited from the hospital. Where's the rest of the town's tanks?"
"I don't know."
"And what could they be using them for?"
"I don't know," Rusty said. "But I mean to find out."
Pink Stars Falling. 1. Barbie and Rusty stepped outside and breathed deeply of the open air. It had a smoky tang from the recently extinguished fires west of town, but seemed very fresh after the exhaust fumes in the shed. A lackadaisical little breeze cat's-pawed their cheeks. Barbie was carrying the Geiger counter in a brown shopping bag he'd found in the fallout shelter. "This shit will not stand," Rusty said. His face was set and grim. "What are you going to do about it?" Barbie asked. "Now, nothing. I'm going back to the hospital and do rounds. Tonight, though, I intend to knock on Jim Rennie's door and ask for a goddamn explanation. He better have one. And he better have the rest of our propane as well, because we're going to be dead out of the hospital by the day after tomorrow, even with every non-essential shut down."
"This might be over by the day after tomorrow."
"Do you believe it will be?"
Instead of answering the question, Barbie said, "Selectman Rennie could be a dangerous man to press right about now."
"Just now? That tags you for a town newbie like nothing else could. I've been hearing that about Big Jim for the 10,000 or so years he's been running this town. He either tells people to get lost or pleads patience for the good of the town, he says. That's number one on his hit parade. Town meeting in March is a joke. In Article 2, authorize a new sewer system? Sorry, the town can't afford the taxes. In Article 2, authorize more commercial zoning? Great idea. The town needs the revenue. Let's build a Walmart out on 117. The University of Maine Small Town Environmental Study says there's too much gray water in Chester Pond. The selectmen recommend tabling discussion because everybody knows all those scientific studies are run by radical, humanist, bleeding-heart atheists. But the hospital is for the good of the town, wouldn't you say?"
"Yes, I would." Barbie was a little bemused by this outburst. Rusty stared at the ground with his hands in his back pockets. Then he looked up.
"I understand the president tapped you to take over. I think it's high time you did so."
"It's an idea," Barbie smiled. "Except, Rennie and Sanders have got their police force. Where's mine?"
Before Rusty could reply, his cell phone rang. He flipped it open and looked at the little window.
"Linda, what?"
He listened.
"All right, I understand. If you're sure they're both okay now. And you're sure it was Judy, not Janelle?"
He listened some more, then said, "I think this is actually good news. I saw 2 of the kids this morning, both with transient seizures that passed off quickly, long before I saw them. And both fine afterward. Had calls on 3 more.
Ginny T. took another one. It could be a side effect of whatever force is powering the dome. He listened. Because I didn't have a chance to, he said. His tone patient, non-confrontational. Barbie could imagine the question which had prompted that. Kids have been having seizures all day, and now you tell me? You're picking the kids up? Rusty asked. He listened. Okay, that's good. If you sense anything wrong, call me ASAP. I'll come on the run. And make sure Audie stays with them.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Love you, too. He hooked the phone on his belt and ran both hands through his hair hard enough to make his eyes look briefly Chinese.
Jesus, jumped up, Christ.
Who's Audie? Our golden retriever. Tell me about these seizures. Rusty did so, not omitting what Janny had said about Halloween and what Judy had said about pink stars.
The Halloween thing sounds like what the Dinsmore boy was raving about, Barbie said.
Does, doesn't it? What about the other kids? Any of them talking about Halloween or pink stars?
The parents I saw today said their kids babbled while the seizure was ongoing, but they were too freaked to pay any attention.
The kids themselves didn't remember?
The kids didn't even know they'd had seizures.
Is that normal?
It's not abnormal.
Any chance your younger daughter was copying the older one? Maybe, I don't know, vying for attention?
Rusty hadn't considered this, hadn't had the time, really.
Now he did.
Possible, but not likely.
He nodded to the old-fashioned yellow Geiger counter in the bag.
You going prospecting with that thing?
Not me, Barbie said. This baby's town property and the powers that be don't like me much. I wouldn't want to be caught with it. He held the bag out to Rusty.
Can't. I'm just too busy right now.
I know, Barbie said, and told Rusty what he wanted him to do. Rusty listened closely, smiling a little.
Okay, he said. Works for me. What are you going to be doing while I'm running your errands?
Cooking dinner at Sweetbriar. Tonight's special is chicken a la Barbara. Want me to send some up to the hospital?
Sweet, Rusty said.
2. On his way back to Kathy Russell, Rusty stopped by the Democrat's office and handed off the Geiger counter to Julia Shumway. She listened as he relayed Barbie's instructions, smiling faintly.
The man knows how to delegate, I'll say that for him. I'll see to this with pleasure.
Rusty thought of cautioning her to be careful about who saw the town's Geiger counter in her possession, but didn't need to. The bag had disappeared into the knee hole of her desk. On his way to the hospital, he reached Ginny Tomlinson and asked her about the seizure call she'd taken.
Little kid named Jimmy Wicker, the grandfather called it in. Bill Wicker?
Rusty knew him. Bill delivered their mail.
He was taking care of Jimmy while the boy's mom went to gas up their car. They're almost out of regular at the gas and grocery, by the way. And Johnny Carver's had the nerve to jack the price of regular to $11 a gallon. 11.
Rusty bore this patiently, thinking he could have had his conversation with Ginny face to face. He was almost back to the hospital. When she was done complaining, he asked her if little Jimmy had said anything while he was seizing.
Yes, indeed. Bill said he babbled quite a bit. I think it was something about pink stars, or Halloween, or maybe I'm getting it confused with what Rory Dinsmore said after he was shot. People have been talking about that.
Of course they have, Rusty thought grimly, and they'll be talking about this, too, if they find out, as they probably will.
All right, he said. Thanks, Ginny.
When you coming back, Red Rider?
Almost there now.
Good. Because we have a new patient, Sammy Bushy. She was raped.
Rusty groaned.
It gets better. Piper Libby brought her in. I couldn't get the names of the doers out of the girl, but I think Piper did. She went out of here like her hair was on fire, and her ass...
A pause. Ginny yawned loud enough for Rusty to hear.
Her ass was catching.
Ginny, my love, when's the last time you got some sleep?
I'm fine.
Go home.
Are you kidding?
Sounding aghast. No. Go home. Sleep. No setting the alarm, either. Then an idea struck him. But, stop by Sweetbriar Rose on the way, why don't you? They're having chicken. I heard it from a reliable source.
The Bushy girl.
I'll be checking on her in 5 minutes. What you're going to do is make like a bee and buzz. He closed his phone before she could protest again. 3. Big Jim Rennie felt remarkably good for a man who had committed murder the night before. This was partially because he did not see it as murder, no more than he had seen the death of his late wife as murder. It was cancer that had taken her, inoperable. Yes, he had probably given her too many of the pain pills over the last week, and in the end he'd still had to help her with a pillow over her face. But lightly, ever so lightly, slowing her breathing, easing her into the arms of Jesus. But he had done it out of love and kindness. What had happened to Reverend Coggins was a bit more brutal, admittedly. But the man had been so bullish, so completely unable to put the town's welfare ahead of his own. "Well, he's eating dinner with Christ the Lord tonight," Big Jim said. "Roast beef mashed with gravy. Apple crisp for dessert." He himself was eating a large plate of fettuccine Alfredo, courtesy of the Stouffer's company. A lot of cholesterol, he supposed, but there was no Dr. Haskell around to nag him about it. "I outlasted you, you old poop," Big Jim told his empty study and laughed good-naturedly. His plate of pasta and a glass filled with milk, Big Jim Rennie did not drink alcohol, were set on his desk blotter. He often ate in the study, and he saw no need to change that simply because Lester Coggins had met his end here. Besides, the room was once more squared away and spandy clean. Oh, he supposed one of those investigation units, like the ones on TV, would be able to find plenty of blood splatter with their luminol and special lights and things. But none of those people was going to be here in the immediate future. As for Pete Randolph doing any sleuthing in the matter, the idea was a joke. Randolph was an idiot. "But," Big Jim told the empty room in a lecturely tone, "he's my idiot." He slurped up the last few strands of pasta, mopped his considerable chin with a napkin, then once more began to jot notes on the yellow legal pad beside the blotter. He had jotted plenty of notes since Saturday. There was so much to do. And if the dome stayed in place, there would be more still. Big Jim sort of hoped it would remain in place, at least for a while. The dome offered challenges to which he felt certain he could rise, with God's help, of course. The first order of business was to consolidate his hold on the town. For that, he needed more than a scapegoat. He needed a boogeyman. The obvious choice was Barbara, the man the Democrat Party's commie-in-chief had tapped to replace James Rennie. The study door opened. When Big Jim looked up from his notes, his son was standing there. His face was pale and expressionless. There was something not quite right about Junior lately. As busy as he was with the town's affairs and their other enterprise that had also kept him busy, Big Jim realized this. But he felt confident in the boy just the same. Even if Junior let him down, Big Jim was sure he could handle it. He spent a lifetime making his own luck. That wasn't going to change now. Besides, the boy had moved the body. That made him part of this, which was good. The essence of small-town life, in fact. In a small town, everybody was supposed to be a part of everything. How did that silly song put it? "We all support the team." "Son," he asked, "all right?" "I'm fine," Junior said. He wasn't, but he was better. The latest poisonous headache finally lifting. Being with his girlfriends had helped, as he'd known it would. The McCain pantry didn't smell so good. But after he'd sat there a while, holding their hands, he'd gotten used to it. He thought he could even come to like that smell. "Did you find anything in his apartment?" "Yes." Junior told him what he had found. "That's excellent, son, really excellent. And are you ready to tell me where you put him? Junior shook his head slowly back and forth, but his eyes stayed in exactly the same place while he did it, pinned on his father's face. It was a little eerie. "You don't need to know. I told you that. It's a safe place, and that's enough." "So now you're telling me what I need to know?" But he said it without his usual heat. "In this case,
Yes.
Big Jim considered his son carefully.
Are you sure you're all right? You look pale.
I'm fine, just a headache. It's going now.
Why not have something to eat? There are a few more fettuccines in the freezer, and the microwave does a great job on them.
He smiled.
Might as well enjoy them while we can.
The dark, considering eyes dropped for a moment to the puddle of white sauce on Big Jim's plate, then rose again to his father's face.
Not hungry. When should I find the bodies?
Bodies?
Big Jim stared.
What do you mean, bodies?
Junior smiled, lips lifting just enough to show the tips of his teeth.
Never mind. It'll help your credit if you're surprised like everyone else. Let's put it this way. Once we pull the trigger, this town will be ready to hang Barbie from a sour apple tree.
When do you want to do it?
Tonight?
Because that'll work. Big Jim considered the question. He looked down at his yellow pad. It was crammed with notes and splattered with Alfredo sauce. But only one was circled. Newspaper bitch.
Not tonight. We can use him for more than Coggins if we play this right.
And if the dome comes down while you're playing it?
We'll be fine, Big Jim said,
thinking, and if Mr. Barber is somehow able to squirm free of the frame, not likely, but cockroaches have a way of finding cracks when the lights go on. There's always you.
You and those other bodies.
Now get yourself something to eat, even if it's only a salad.
But Junior didn't move.
Don't wait too long, Dad, he said.
I won't.
Junior considered it, considered him, with those dark eyes that seemed so strange now. Then seemed to lose interest. He yawned.
I'm going up to my room and sleep a while. I'll eat later.
Just make sure you do. You're getting too thin.
Thin is in, his son replied, and offered a hollow smile that was even more disquieting than his eyes.
To Big Jim, it looked like a skull smile. It made him think of the fellow who now just called himself the chef, as if his previous life as Phil Bushy had been canceled. When Junior left the room, Big Jim breathed a sigh of relief, without even being aware of it. He picked up his pen. So much to do. He would do it and do it well. It was not impossible that when this thing was over, his picture would be on the cover of Time magazine. 4. With her generator still running, although it wouldn't be for much longer unless she could find some more LP canisters, Brenda Perkins was able to fire up her husband's printer and make a hard copy of everything in the Vader file. The incredible list of offenses Howie had compiled, and which he had apparently been about to act on at the time of his death, seemed more real to her on paper than they had on the computer screen. And the more she looked at them, the more they seemed to fit the Jim Rennie she'd known for most of her life. She had always known he was a monster, just not how big a monster. Even the stuff about Coggins's Jesus-jumping church fit. Although if she was reading this right, it was really not a church at all, but a big old holy Maytag that washed money instead of clothes. Money from a drug manufacturing operation that was, in her husband's words, maybe one of the biggest in the history of the United States. But there were problems, which both Police Chief Howie Duke Perkins and the state AG had acknowledged. The problems were why the evidence-gathering phase of Operation Vader had gone on as long as it had. Jim Rennie wasn't just a big monster. He was a smart monster. That was why he had always been content to remain the second selectman. He had Andy Sanders to break trail for him. And to wear a target, that too. For a long time, Andy was the only one against whom Howie had had hard evidence. He was the front man, and probably didn't even know it. Cheery, glad-handing, dumb shit that he was. Andy was first selectman, first deacon at Holy Redeemer, first in the hearts of the townsfolk, and out front on a trail of corporate documents that finally disappeared into the obfuscatory financial swamps of Nassau and Grand Cayman Island. If Howie and the state attorney general had moved too soon, he would also have been first to get his picture taken while holding a number. Maybe the only one, should he believe Big Jim's inevitable promises that all would be well if Andy just kept mum. And he probably would. who was better at dummying up than a dummy? Last summer, things had begun working toward what Howie had seen as the endgame. That was when Rennie's name had started showing up on some of the paperwork the AG had obtained. Most notably, that of a Nevada corporation called Town Ventures. The Town Ventures money had disappeared west instead of east, not into the Caribbean, but into mainland China, a country where the key ingredients of decongestant drugs could be bought in bulk with few or any questions. Why would Rennie allow such exposure? Howie Perkins had been able to think of only one reason. The money had gotten too big too fast for one holy washing machine. Rennie's name had subsequently appeared on papers concerning half a dozen other fundamentalist churches in the Northeast. Town Ventures and the other churches, not to mention half a dozen other religious radio stations and AM talkers, known as big as WCIK, were Rennie's first real mistakes. They left dangling strings. Strings could be pulled, and sooner or later, usually sooner, everything unraveled.
You couldn't let go, could you? Brenda thought, as she sat behind her husband's desk studying the papers. You'd made millions, maybe tens of millions, and the risks were becoming outrageous, but you still couldn't let go. Like a monkey who traps himself because he won't let go of the food. You were sitting on a damn fortune, and you just kept on living in that old three-story and selling cars at that pit of yours out on 119. Why? But she knew. It wasn't the money, it was the town. What he saw as his town, sitting on a beach somewhere in Costa Rica or presiding over a guarded estate in Namibia, Big Jim would become Small Jim. Because a man without a sense of purpose, even one whose bank accounts are stuffed with money, is always a small man. If she confronted him with what she had, could she make a deal with him? Force him out in return for her silence? She wasn't sure, and she dreaded the confrontation. It would be ugly, possibly dangerous. She would want to have Julia Shumway with her, and Barbie. Only Dale Barbara was now wearing his own target. Howie's voice, calm but firm, spoke up in her head. You can afford to wait a little while. I was waiting for a few final items of proof myself. But I wouldn't wait too long, honey. Because the longer this siege goes on, the more dangerous he'll become. She thought of Howie starting to back down the driveway, then stopping to put his lips on hers in the sunshine, his mouth almost as well known to her as her own, and certainly as well loved, caressing the side of her throat as he did it, as if he knew the end was coming, and one last touch would have to pay for all. An easy and romantic conceit for sure, but she almost believed it, and her eyes filled with tears. Suddenly the papers and all the machinations contained therein seemed less important. Even the dome didn't seem very important. What mattered was the hole that had appeared so suddenly in her life, sucking out the happiness she had taken for granted. She wondered if poor, dumb Andy Sanders felt the same way. She supposed he did. I'll give it 24 hours. If the dome's still in place tomorrow night, I'll go to Rennie with this stuff. With copies of this stuff, and tell him he has to resign in favor of Dale Barbara. Tell him that if he doesn't, he's going to read all about his drug operation in the paper. Tomorrow,
she murmured, and closed her eyes. 2 minutes later, she was asleep in Howie's chair. In Chester's Mill, the supper hour had come. Some meals, including chicken a la king for 100 or so, were cooked on electric or gas ranges, courtesy of the generators in town that were still working. But there were also people who had turned to their wood stoves, either to conserve their jennies or because wood was now all they had. The smoke rose in the still air from hundreds of chimneys and spread. 5. After delivering the Geiger counter, the recipient took it willingly, even eagerly, and promised to begin prospecting with it early on Tuesday. Julia headed for Burpee's department store with Horace on his leash. Romeo had told her he had a pair of brand new photocopiers in storage, both still in their original shipping cartons. She was welcome to both. I also got a little propane tucked away, he said, giving Horace a pat. I'll see you get what you need, for as long as I can, at least.
We got to keep that newspaper running, am I right? More important than ever, don't you think?
It was exactly what she taught. And Julia had told him so. She had also planted a kiss on his cheek.
I owe you for this, Rami.
I'll be expecting a big discount on my weekly advertising circular when this is over.
He had then tapped the side of his nose with a forefinger, as if they had a great big secret.
Maybe they did.
As she left, her cell phone chirruped. She pulled it out of her pants pocket.
Hello, this is Julia.
Good evening, Miss Shumway.
Oh, Colonel Cox, how wonderful to hear your voice, she said brightly. You can't imagine how thrilled we country mice are to get out-of-town calls. How's life outside the dome?
Life in general is probably fine, he said. Where I am, it's on the shabby side. You know about the missiles.
Watch them hit and bounce off. They lit a fine fire on your side.
It's not my,
and a fairly good one on ours.
I'm calling for Colonel Barbara,
Cox said,
who should be carrying his own goddamn phone by now.
Goddamn right, she cried, still in her brightest tone. And people in goddamn hell should have goddamn ice water.
She stopped in front of the gas and grocery, now shut up tight. The hand-lettered sign in the window read, Hours of op tomorrow, 11 a.m., 2 p.m. Get here early.
Ms. Shumway, we'll discuss Colonel Barbara in a minute, Julia said. Right now, I want to know two things. First, when is the press going to be allowed at the dome? Because the people of America deserve more than the government's spin on this, don't you think?
She expected him to say he did not think that there would be no New York Times or CNN at the dome in the foreseeable future, but Cox surprised her.
Probably by Friday, if none of the other tricks up our sleeve work. What's the other thing you want to know, Ms. Shumway? Make it brief, because I'm not a press officer. That's another pay grade.
You called me, so you're stuck with me. Suck it up, Colonel.
Ms. Shumway, with all due respect, yours is not the only cell phone in Chester's Mill I can reach out and touch.
I'm sure that's true, but I don't think Barbie will talk to you if you shine me on. He's not particularly happy with his new position as prospective stockade commandant.
Cox sighed.
What's your question?
I want to know the temperature on the south or east side of the dome. A true temperature, meaning away from the fire you guys set.
Why?
Do you have that information or not? I think you do, or can get it. I think you're sitting in front of a computer screen right now, and you have access to everything, probably including my underwear size.
She paused.
And if you say 16, this call is over.
Are you exhibiting your sense of humor, Miss Shumway, or are you always this way?
I'm tired and scared. Chalk it up to that.
There was a pause on Cox's end. She thought she heard the click of computer keys. Then he said,
It's 47 Fahrenheit in Castle Rock. Will that do?
Yes.
The disparity wasn't as bad as she had feared, but still considerable.
I'm looking at the thermometer in the window of the Mill Gas and Grocery. It says 58. That's an 11-degree difference between locations less than 20 miles apart. Unless there's a hell of a big warm front pushing through western Maine this evening, I'd say something's going on here. Do you agree?
He didn't answer her question, but what he did say took her mind off it.
We're going to try something else. Around 9 this evening. That's what I wanted to tell Barbie.
One hopes Plan B will work better than Plan A. At this moment, I believe the president's appointee is feeding the multitudes at Sweetbriar Rose. Chicken a la king is the rumor.
She could see the lights down the street, and her belly rumbled.
Will you listen and pass on a message?
And she heard what he did not add. You contentious bitch.
Happy to, she said, smiling, because she was a contentious bitch when she had to be.
We're going to try an experimental acid, a hydrofluoric compound, man-made, 9 times as corrosive as the ordinary stuff.
Living better through chemistry.
I'm told you could theoretically burn a hole 2 miles deep in the bedrock with it.
What highly amusing people you work for, Colonel.
We're going to try where Motton Road crosses.
There was a rustle of paper.
Where it crosses into Harlow. I expect to be there.
Then I'll tell Barbie to have someone else wash up.
Will you also be favoring us with your company, Miss Shumway? She opened her mouth to say, I wouldn't miss it, and that was when all hell broke loose up the street. What's going on there? Cox asked.
Julia didn't reply.
She closed her phone and stuck it in her pocket, already running toward the sound of yelling voices, and something else. Something that sounded like snarling. The gunshot came while she was still half a block away. 6. Piper went back to the parsonage and discovered Carolyn, Thurston, and the Appleton kids waiting there.
She was glad to see them, because they took her mind off Sammy Bushy.
At least temporarily. She listened to Carolyn's account of Aiden Appleton's seizure, but the boy seemed fine now, chowing ever deeper into a stack of Fig Newtons. When Carolyn asked if the boy should see a doctor, Piper said,
Unless there's a recurrence, I think you can assume it was brought on by hunger and the excitement of the game.
Thurston smiled ruefully.
We were all excited, having fun.
When it came to possible lodging, Piper first thought of the McCain house, which was close by. Only she didn't know where their spare key might be hidden. Alice Appleton was on the floor, feeding Fig Newton crumbs to Clover. The shepherd was doing the old my muzzles on your ankle because I'm your best friend routine in between offerings.
This is the best dog I've ever seen, she told Piper. I wish we could have a dog.
I've got a dragon,
Aiden offered. He was sitting comfortably on Carolyn's lap. Alice smiled indulgently.
That's his invisible F-R-E-I-N.
I see, Piper said. She supposed they could always break a window at the McCain place. Needs must when the devil drives. But as she got up to check on the coffee, a better idea occurred. The Dumagens. I should have thought of them right away. They went to Boston for a conference. Coralie Dumagen asked me to water her plants while they're gone.
I teach in Boston, Thurston said. At Emerson, I edited the current issue of Plowshares.
And sighed.
The key is under a flower pot to the left of the door, Piper said. I don't believe they have a generator, but there's a wood stove in the kitchen.
She hesitated, thinking, city people. Can you use a wood stove to cook on without setting the house on fire?
I grew up in Vermont, Thurston said. Was in charge of keeping the stoves lit, house and barn, until I went off to college. What goes around comes around, doesn't it?
And he sighed again.
There'll be food in the pantry, I'm sure, Piper said.
Carolyn nodded.
That's what the janitor at the town hall said. Also, Junior, Alice put in. He's a cop. A foxy one.
Thurston's mouth turned down.
Alice's foxy cop assaulted me, he said. Him or the other one? I couldn't tell them apart myself.
Piper's eyebrows went up.
Punched Thurston in the stomach, Carolyn said quietly. Called us massholes, which I suppose we technically are, and laughed at us. For me, that was the worst part, how they laughed at us. They were better once they had the kids with them, but... She shook her head. They were out of control.
And just like that, Piper was back to Sammy. She felt a pulse beginning to beat in the side of her neck. Very slow and hard, but she kept her voice even.
What was the other policeman's name?
Frankie, Carolyn said. Junior called him Frankie D. Do you know these guys?
You must, huh?
I know them, Piper said. 7. She gave the new makeshift family directions to the Dumagens. The house had the advantage of being near to Kathy Russell if the boy had another seizure, and sat a while at her kitchen table after they were gone, drinking tea. She did it slowly. Took a sip and set the cup down. Took a sip and set it down. Clover whined. He was tuned into her, and she supposed he could sense her rage. Maybe it changes my smell, makes it more acrid or something. A picture was forming, not a pretty one. A lot of new cops, very young cops, sworn in less than 48 hours ago and already running wild. The sort of license they had exhibited with Sammy Bushy and Thurston Marshall wouldn't spread to veteran cops like Henry Morrison and Jackie Weddington. At least she didn't think so. But to Fred Denton? Toby Whalen? Maybe. Probably. With Duke in charge, those guys had been all right. Not great. The kind of guys apt to lip you unnecessarily after a traffic stop, but all right. Certainly the best the town's budget could afford. But her mother had been wont to say, you buy cheap, you get cheap. And with Peter Randolph in charge, something had to be done. Only she had to control her temper. If she didn't, it would control her. She took the leash from the peg by the door. Clover was up at once, tail swishing, ears perked, eyes bright. Come on, you big log, we're going to lodge a complaint. Her shepherd was still licking Fig Newton crumbs from the side of his muzzle as she led him out the door. 8. Walking across the town common with Clover heeling neatly to her right, Piper felt she did have her temper under control. She felt that way until she heard the laughter. It came as she and Clover were approaching the police station. She observed the very fellows whose names she had gotten out of Sammy Bushy. De Lesseps, Thibodeau, Searles. Georgia Rue was also present. Georgia, who had egged them on, according to Sammy, do that bitch. Freddie Denton was there, too. They were sitting at the top of the stone PD steps, drinking sodas, gassing among themselves. Duke Perkins never would have allowed such a thing. And Piper reflected that if he could see them from wherever he was, he'd be rolling in his grave fast enough to set his own remains on fire. Mel Searles said something, and they all broke up again, laughing and backslapping. Thibodeau had his arm around the Rue girl, the tips of his fingers on the side swell of her breast. She said something, and they all laughed harder. It came to Piper that they were laughing about the rape. What a gall-durned good old time it had been. And after that, her father's advice never had a chance. The Piper who ministered to the poor and the sick, who officiated at marryings and buryings, who preached charity and tolerance on Sundays, was pushed rudely to the back of her mind, where she could only watch as though through a warped and wavery pane of glass. It was the other Piper who took over, the one who had trashed her room at 15, crying tears of rage rather than sorrow. There was a slate-paved square known as War Memorial Plaza between the town hall and the newer brick PD building. At its center was a statue of Ernie Calvert's father, Lucian Calvert, who had been awarded a posthumous Silver Star for heroic action in Korea. The names of other Chester's Mill war dead, going all the way back to the Civil War, were engraved on the statue's base. There were also two flagpoles, the stars and stripes at the top of one, and the state flag, with its farmer, sailor, and moose, at the top of the other. Both hung limp in the reddening light of oncoming sunset. Piper Libby passed between the poles like a woman in a dream. Clover still heeling behind her right knee with his ears up. The officers atop the steps burst into another hearty roar of laughter, and she thought of trolls in one of the fairy stories her dad had sometimes read her. Trolls in a cave, gloating over piles of ill-gotten gold. Then they saw her, and quieted. "Good evening, Reverend," Mel Searles said, and got up, giving his belt a self-important little hitch as he did so. Standing in the presence of a lady, Piper thought, did his mother teach him that? Probably. The fine art of rape he probably learned somewhere else. He was still smiling as she reached the steps, but then it faltered and grew tentative, so he must have seen her expression. Just what that expression might be, she didn't know. From the inside, her face felt frozen, immobile. She saw the biggest of them watching her closely. Thibodeau, his face as immobile as hers felt. He's like Clover, she thought. He smells it on me. The rage.
Reverend, Mel asked, everything okay? There a problem?
She mounted the steps, not fast, not slow. Clover still heeling neatly behind her right knee. You bet there's a problem, she said, looking up at him. What? You, she said, you're the problem. She pushed him. Mel wasn't expecting it. He was still holding his cup of soda. He went tumbling into Georgia Rue's lap, flailing his arms uselessly for balance. And for a moment, the soda was a dark manta ray hanging against the reddening sky. Georgia cried out in surprise as Mel landed on her. She sprawled backward, spilling her own soda. They went running across the wide granite slab in front of the double doors. Piper could smell either whiskey or bourbon. Their cokes had been spiked with what the rest of the town could no longer buy. No wonder they'd been laughing. The red fissure inside her head opened wider.
You can't...
Frankie began, starting to get up himself. She pushed him. In a galaxy far, far away, Clover, ordinarily the sweetest of dogs, was growling. Frankie went on his back, eyes wide and startled for a moment, looking like the Sunday schoolboy he once might have been.
Rape is the problem, Piper shouted. Rape.
Shut up, Carter said. He was still sitting. And although Georgia was cowering against him, Carter remained calm. The muscles of his arms rippled below his short-sleeved blue shirt. Shut up and get out of here right now, if you don't want to spend the night in a cell downstairs.
You're the one who'll be going into a cell, Piper said. All of you.
Make her shut up, Georgia said. She wasn't whimpering, but she was close.
Make her shut up, Car.
Ma'am, Freddie Denton. His uniform, shirt untucked and bourbon on his breath, Duke would have taken one look and fired his ass, fired all their asses. He started to get up, and this time he was the one who went sprawling, a look of surprise on his face that would have been comical under other circumstances. It was nice that they had been sitting while she was standing, made it easier. But oh, how her temples were thudding. She returned her attention to Thibodeau, the most dangerous one. He was still looking at her with maddening calm, as though she were a freak he'd paid a quarter to see in a sideshow tent. But he was looking up at her, and that was her advantage.
But it won't be a cell downstairs, she said, speaking directly to Thibodeau. It'll be in Shawshank, where they do to little playyard bullies like you what you did to that girl.
You stupid bitch, Carter said. He spoke as if remarking on the weather. We weren't anywhere near her house.
That's right, Georgia said, sitting up again.
There was coke splattered on one of her cheeks, where a virulent case of teenage acne was fading, but still holding on to a few final outposts.
And besides, everyone knows Sammy Bushy is nothing but a lying lesbo cunt.
Piper's lips stretched in a smile. She turned it on Georgia, who recoiled from the crazy lady who had appeared so suddenly on the steps while they'd been having a nice sunsetter or two.
How did you know the lying lesbo cunt's name? I didn't say it.
Georgia's mouth dropped into an O of dismay, and for the first time something flickered beneath Carter Thibodeau's calm. Whether fear or just annoyance, Piper didn't know. Frank de Lesseps got cautiously to his feet.
You better not go around spreading accusations you can't back up, Reverend Libby.
Nor assaulting police officers, Freddie Denton said. I'm willing to let it go this time. Everyone's under stress, but you have to cease and desist these accusations right now.
He paused, then added lamely, and the pushing, of course. Piper's gaze remained fixed on Georgia. Her right hand curled so tightly around the black plastic grip of Clover's leash it was throbbing. The dog stood with his forepaws spread and his head lowered, still growling. He sounded like a powerful outboard motor set to idle. The fur on his neck had bushed out enough to hide his collar.
How'd you know her name, Georgia? I just assumed.
Carter gripped her shoulder and squeezed it. Shut up, babe. And then to Piper, still not standing, because he doesn't want to be pushed back down, the coward. He said,
I don't know what kind of bee you've got in your Jesus bonnet, but we were all together last night at Alden Dinsmore's farm, trying to see if we could get anything out of the soldier boys station on 119, which we couldn't.
That's on the other side of town, from Bushy's.
He looked around at his friends.
Right, Frankie said.
Right,
Mel chimed in, looking at Piper distrustfully.
Yeah.
Georgia said. Carter's arm was around her again, and her moment of doubt was gone. She looked at Piper defiantly.
Georgie girl assumed it was Sammy you were yelling about, Carter said with that same infuriating calm, because Sammy's the biggest lying scumbucket in this town.
Mel Searles yodeled laughter.
But you didn't use protection, Piper said.
Sammy had told her this, and when she saw Thibodeau's face tighten, she knew it was true.
You didn't use protection, and they rape-kitted her.
She had no idea if this was true, and didn't care. She could see from their widening eyes that they believed it, and their belief was enough.
When they compare your DNA to what they found...
That's enough, Carter said. Shut it.
She turned her furious smile on him. No, Mr. Thibodeau, we are only getting started, my son. Freddie Denton reached for her. She pushed him down, then felt her left arm caught and twisted. She turned and looked into Thibodeau's eyes. No calm there now. They were shining with rage.
Hello, my brother, she thought incoherently.
Fuck you, you fucking bitch, he remarked. And this time, she was the one who was pushed. Piper fell backward down the stairs, trying instinctively to tuck and roll, not wanting to hit her head on one of those stone risers, knowing they could smash her skull in, kill her, or worse, leave her a vegetable. She struck on her left shoulder instead, and there was a sudden howl of pain there. Familiar pain. She had dislocated that one playing high school soccer 20 years ago, and damned if she hadn't just done it again. Her legs flew over her head, and she turned a back somersault, wrenching her neck, coming down on her knees, and splitting the skin on both. She finally came to rest on her stomach and breasts. She had tumbled almost all the way to the bottom of the steps. Her cheek was bleeding. Her nose was bleeding. Her lips were bleeding. Her neck hurt, but ah, God, her shoulder was the worst, humped all up, crooked in a way she remembered well. The last time she'd seen a hump like that, it had been in a red nylon Wildcats jersey. Nevertheless, she struggled to her feet, thanking God she still had the power to command her legs. She could also have been paralyzed. She'd lost hold of the leash halfway down, and Clover jumped at Thibodeau, his teeth snapping at the chest and belly under his shirt, tearing the shirt open, knocking Thibodeau backward, going for the young man's vitals.
"Get him off me!" Carter screamed.
Nothing calm about him now.
"He's gonna kill me!"
And, yes, Clover was trying. His front paws were planted on Carter's thighs, going up and down as Carter thrashed. He looked like a German shepherd on a bicycle. He shifted his angle of attack and bit deep into Carter's shoulder, eliciting another scream. Then Clover went for the throat. Carter got his hands on the dog's chest, just in time to save his windpipe.
"Make him stop!"
Frank reached for the trailing leash. Clover turned and snapped at his fingers. Frank skittered backward, and Clover returned his attention to the man who had pushed his mistress down the steps. His muzzle opened, revealing a double line of shining white teeth, and he drove at Thibodeau's neck. Carter got his hand up, then shrieked in agony as Clover seized on it and began to shake it like one of his beloved rag toys. Only his rag toys didn't bleed, and Carter's hand did. Piper came staggering up the steps, holding her left arm across her midriff. Her face was a mask of blood. A tooth clung to the corner of her mouth like a crumb of food.
"Get him off me! Christ, get your fucking dog off me!"
Piper was opening her mouth to tell Clover to stand down when she saw Fred Denton drawing his gun.
"No," she screamed, "no, I can make him stop."
Fred turned to Mel Searles and pointed at the dog with his free hand. Mel stepped forward and kicked Clover in the haunch. He did it high and hard, as he had once, not so long ago, punted footballs. Clover was whipped sideways, losing his hold on Thibodeau's bleeding, shredded hand, where two fingers now pointed in unusual directions, like crooked signposts.
"No!"
Piper screamed again, so loud and so hard the world went gray before her eyes.
"Don't hurt my dog!"
Fred paid no attention. When Peter Randolph burst out through the double doors, his shirt tail out, his pants unzipped, the copy of Outdoors he had been reading on the crapper still held in one hand, Fred paid no attention to that either. He pointed his service automatic at the dog and fired. The sound was deafening in the enclosed square. The top of Clover's head lifted off in a spray of blood and bone. He took one step towards his screaming, bleeding mistress. Another. Then collapsed. Fred, gun still in hand, strode forward and grabbed Piper by her bad arm. The hump in her shoulder roared a protest. And still she kept her eyes on the corpse of her dog, whom she had raised from a pup.
"You're under arrest, you crazy bitch," Fred said.
He pushed his face pale, sweaty, the eyes seeming ready to pop right out of their sockets, close enough to hers for her to feel the spray of his spittle.
"Anything you say can and will be used against your crazy ass."
On the other side of the street, diners were pouring out of Sweetbriar Rose, Barbie among them still wearing his apron and baseball cap. Julia Shumway arrived first. She took in the scene, not seeing details so much as a gestalt summation. Dead dog, clustered cops, bleeding, screaming woman with one shoulder higher than the other, bald cop, Freddy goddamn Denton, shaking her by the arm connected to that shoulder, more blood on the steps, suggesting that Piper had fallen down them or had been pushed. Julia did something she had never done before in her life, reached into her handbag, flipped her wallet open, and climbed the steps, holding it out, yelling, "Press! Press! Press!" It stopped the shaking, at least. 9. 10 minutes later, in the office that had been Duke Perkins not so long ago, Carter Thibodeau sat on the sofa under Duke's framed pictures and certificates, with a fresh bandage on his shoulder and paper towels around his hand. Georgia was sitting beside him. Large beads of pain sweat stood out on Thibodeau's forehead. But after saying, "I don't think nothing's broken," he was silent. Fred Denton sat in a chair in the corner. His gun was on the chief's desk. He had surrendered it willingly enough, only saying, "I had to do it. Just look at Cart's hand." Piper sat in the office chair that was now Peter Randolph's. Julia had mopped most of the blood off Piper's face with more paper towels. The woman was shivering with shock and in great pain, but she was as silent about it as Thibodeau. Her eyes were clear.
"Clover only attacked him."
She raised her chin to Carter.
"After, he pushed me down the stairs. The push caused me to lose hold of my leash. What my dog did was justified. He was protecting me from a criminal assault."
"She attacked us," Georgia cried. "Crazy bitch attacked us. Came up the steps spouting all this shit."
"Shut up," Barbie said. "All of you, shut the hell up." He looked at Piper. "This isn't the first time you've dislocated your shoulder, is it?" "I want you out of here, Mr. Barbara," Randolph said, but he spoke with no great conviction. "I can deal with this," Barbie said. "Can you?" Randolph made no reply. Mel Searles and Frank the Lessop stood outside the door. They looked worried. Barbie turned back to Piper. "This is a subluxation, a partial separation. Not bad. I can pop it back in before you go to the hospital."
"Hospital?"
Fred Denton squawked.
"She's under arrest."
"Shut up, Freddy," Randolph said. "Nobody's under arrest. At least, not yet." Barbie held Piper's eyes with his own. "But I have to do it now. Before the swelling gets bad. If you wait for Everett to do it at the hospital, they'll have to give you anesthesia." He leaned close to her ear and murmured, "While you're out, they'll be telling their side, and you won't be telling yours." "What are you saying?" Randolph asked sharply.
"That it's going to hurt," Barbie said.
"Right, Rev?" She nodded.
"Go on. Coach Gromley did it right on the sidelines, and she was a total dope. Just hurry. And please, don't screw it up."
Barbie said, "Julia, grab a sling from the first aid kit, then help me lie her down on her back." Julia, very pale and feeling ill, did as she was told. Barbie sat down on the floor to Piper's left, slipped off one shoe, and then grasped her forearm just above her wrist with both hands. "I don't know Coach Gromley's method," he said, "but this is how a medic I knew in Iraq did it. You're going to count to three, and then yell wishbone."
"Wishbone," Piper said, bemused in spite of the pain. "Well, okay. You're the doctor."
No, Julia thought. Rusty Everett was now the closest thing the town had to a doctor. She'd contacted Linda and gotten his cell phone number, but her call had been immediately shunted to voicemail. The room was silent. Even Carter Thibodeau was watching. Barbie nodded to Piper. Beads of sweat stood out on her forehead. But she had her game face on, and Barbie respected the shit out of that. He slipped his sock foot into her left armpit, snugging it tight. Then, while pulling slowly but steadily on her arm, he applied counter pressure with his foot. "Okay, here we go. Let's hear you."
"One, two, three. Wishbone."
When Piper shouted, Barbie pulled. Everyone in the room heard the loud thunk as the joint went back into place. The hump in Piper's blouse magically disappeared. She screamed, but didn't pass out. He slipped the sling over her neck and around the arm, immobilizing it as well as he could. "Better?" he asked.
"Better," she said. "Much, thank God. Still hurts, but not as bad."
"I've got some aspirin in my purse," Julia said. "Give her the aspirin and then get out," Randolph said, All of you, except for Carter, Freddy, the Reverend, and me.
Julia looked at him unbelievingly.
Are you kidding? The Reverend is going to the hospital. Can you walk, Piper?
Piper stood up shakily.
I think so. A little way.
Sit down, Reverend Libby, Randolph said, but Barbie knew she was already gone. He could hear it in Randolph's voice.
Why don't you make me?
She gingerly lifted her left arm in the sling holding it. The arm trembled, but it was working.
I'm sure you can dislocate it again very easily. Go on, show these boys that you're just like them.
And I'll put it all in the paper, Julia said brightly. Circulation will double.
Barbie said, suggest you defer this business until tomorrow, Chief. Allow the lady to get some painkillers stronger than aspirin, and have those knee lacerations checked by Everett. Given the dome, she's hardly a flight risk.
Her dog tried to kill me, Carter said.
In spite of the pain, he sounded calm again.
Chief Randolph, the Lesseps, Searles, and Thibodeau are guilty of rape.
Piper was swaying now. Julia put an arm around her, but her voice was firm and clear.
Rue is an accessory to rape. The hell I am,
Georgia squawked. They need to be suspended immediately.
She's lying, Thibodeau said.
Chief Randolph looked like a man watching a tennis match. He finally settled his gaze on Barbie.
Are you telling me what to do, kiddo?
No, sir, just making a suggestion based on my enforcement experience in Iraq.
You'll make your own decisions.
Randolph relaxed.
Okay, then. Okay.
He looked down, frowning in thought. They all watched him notice his fly was still unzipped and take care of that little problem. Then he looked up again and said,
Julia, take Reverend Piper to the hospital. As for you, Mr. Barbara, I don't care where you go, but I want you out of here. I'll take statements from my officers tonight and from Reverend Libby tomorrow.
Wait, Thibodeau said. He extended his crooked fingers to Barbie. Can you do anything about these?
I don't know, Barbie said. Pleasantly enough, he hoped.
The initial ugliness was over, and now came the political aftermath, which he remembered well from dealing with Iraqi cops who were not all that different from the man on the couch and the others crowding the doorway. What it came down to was making nice with people you wished you could spit on.
Can you say wishbone?
10. Rusty had turned his cell phone off before knocking on Big Jim's door. Now Big Jim sat behind his desk, Rusty in the seat before it, the chair of supplicants and applicants. The study, Rennie probably called it a home office on his tax returns, had a pleasant piney smell, as if it had recently been given a good scrubbing, but Rusty still didn't like it. It wasn't just the picture of an aggressively Caucasian Jesus delivering the Sermon on the Mount, or the self-congratulatory plaques, or the hardwood floor that really should have had a rug to protect it. It was all those things, and something else as well. Rusty Everett had very little use for or belief in the supernatural, but nevertheless, this room felt almost haunted.
It's because he scares you a little, he thought. That's all it is.
Hoping that how he felt didn't show in his voice or face, Rusty told Rennie about the hospital's missing propane tanks, about how he had found one of them in the supply shed behind the town hall, currently running the town hall's generator, and how it was the only one.
So, I have two questions, Rusty said. How did a tank from the hospital supply wander downtown? And where did the rest go?
Big Jim rocked back in his chair, put his hands behind his neck, and looked up at the ceiling meditatively. Rusty found himself staring at the trophy baseball sitting on Rennie's desk. Propped in front of it was a note from Bill Lee, once of the Boston Red Sox. He could read the note because it was turned outward. Of course it was. It was for guests to see, to marvel over. Like the pictures on the wall, the baseball proclaimed that Big Jim Rennie had rubbed elbows with famous people. Look on my autographs, ye mighty, and despair. To Rusty, the baseball in the note turned outward seemed to sum up his bad feelings about the room he was in. It was window dressing, a tinny testimonial to small-town prestige and small-town power. I wasn't aware you had anyone's permission to go poking around in our supply shed, Big Jim remarked to the ceiling. His hammy fingers were still laced together behind his head. Perhaps you're a town official and I wasn't aware of it. If so, my mistake, my bad, as Junior says. I thought you were basically a nurse with a prescription pad. Rusty thought this was mostly technique, Rennie trying to piss him off, to divert him. I'm not a town official, he said, but I am a hospital employee and a taxpayer. So? Rusty could feel blood rushing to his face. So those things make it partly my supply shed. He waited to see if Big Jim would respond to this, but the man behind the desk remained impassive. Besides, it was unlocked, which is all beside the point, isn't it? I saw what I saw, and I'd like an explanation. As a hospital employee. And a taxpayer, don't forget that. Rusty sat looking at him, not even nodding. I can't give you one, Rennie said. Rusty raised his eyebrows. Really, I thought you had your fingers on the pulse of this town. Isn't that what you said the last time you ran for selectman? And now you're telling me you can't explain where the town's propane went? I don't believe it. For the first time, Rennie looked nettled. I don't care if you believe it or not. This is news to me. But his eyes darted fractionally to one side as he said it, as if to check that his autographed photo of Tiger Woods was still there. The classic liar's tell. Rusty said, The hospital's almost out of LP. Without it, the few of us who are still in the job might as well be working in a Civil War battlefield surgery tent. Our current patients, including a post-coronary and a serious case of diabetes that may warrant amputation, will be in serious trouble if the power goes out. The possible amp is Jimmy Seroy. His car is in the parking lot. It's got a sticker on the bumper that says, Elect Big Jim. I'll investigate, Big Jim said. He spoke with the air of a man conferring a favor. This town's propane is probably stored in some other town facility. As for yours, I'm sure I can't say. What other town facilities? There's the FD and the sand and salt pile out on God Creek Road. Not even a shed there, but those are the only ones I'm aware of. Mr. Everett, I'm a busy man. You'll have to excuse me now. Rusty stood. His hands wanted to ball into fists, but he wouldn't let them. I'm going to ask you one more time, he said, straight out and straight up. Do you know where those missing tanks are?
No.
This time, it was Dale Earnhardt, Rennie's eyes flickered to. And I'm not going to read any implication into that question, son, because if I did, I'd have to resent it. Now why don't you run along, check on Jimmy Seroy. Tell him Big Jim sends his best, and he'll stop by as soon as the nitpickery slows down a little. Rusty was still battling to hold on to his temper, but this was a fight he was losing. Run along? I think you forgot that you're a public servant, not a private dictator. For the time being, I'm this town's chief medical officer, and I want some an... Big Jim's cell rang. He snared it, listened. The lines around his drawn-down mouth grew grimmer. Gosh darn it, every time I turn my darn back! He listened some more, then said, If you've got people with you in the office, Pete, shut your trap before you open it too wide and fall right the heck in. Call Andy. I'll be right there, and the three of us will clean this up. He killed the phone and got to his feet. I have to go to the police station. It's either an emergency or more nitpickery. I won't be able to tell which until I get there. And you'll be wanted at either the hospital or the health center, I believe. There seems to be a problem with the Reverend Libby.
Why, what happened to her?
Big Jim's cold eyes surveyed him from hard little sockets. I'm sure you'll hear her story. I don't know how true it'll be, but I'm sure you'll hear it. So go do your job, young fella. And let me do mine. Rusty walked down the front hall and out of the house, his temples throbbing. In the west, the sunset was a lurid blood show. The air was almost completely still, but bore a smoky stench just the same. At the foot of the steps,
Rusty raised a finger and pointed it at the public servant waiting for him to leave his property before he, Rennie, left himself. Rennie scowled at the finger, but Rusty did not drop it.
Nobody needs to tell me to do my job, and I'm going to make looking for that propane part of it. If I find it in the wrong place, someone else is going to be doing your job, Selectman Rennie. That's a promise.
Big Jim flapped a contemptuous hand at him. Get out of here, son. Go to work.
11. During the first 55 hours of the dome's existence, over 24 children suffered seizures. Some, like those of the Everett girls, were noted. Many more were not. And in the days ahead, the seizure activity would rapidly taper down to nothing. Rusty would compare this to the minor shocks people experienced when they came too close to the dome. The first time, you got that almost electric frisson that stiffened the hair on the back of your neck. After that, most people felt nothing. It was as if they had been inoculated.
Are you saying the dome is like chickenpox? Linda asked him later. Catch it once and you're set for life?
Janelle had 2 seizures, and so did a little kid named Norman Sawyer, but in both cases the second seizure was milder than the first, and not accompanied by any babble. Most of the kids Rusty saw had only the one, and there seemed to be no after effects. Only 2 adults had seizures during those first 55 hours. Both came around sunset on Monday evening, and both had easily traceable causes.
With Phil Bushy, a.k.a. the chef, the cause was too much of his own product. Around the time Rusty and Big Jim parted company, Chef Bushy was sitting outside the storage barn behind WCIK, looking dreamily at the sunset. This close to the missile strikes, the scarlet in the sky was further darkened by soot on the dome, his hitty pipe clasped loosely in one hand.
He was tweaked at least to the ionosphere, maybe 100 miles beyond.
In the few low-lying clouds which floated on that bloody light, he saw the faces of his mother, his father, his grandfather. He saw Sammy and little Walter as well. All the cloud faces were bleeding. When his right foot began to twitch and then his left foot picked up the beat, he ignored it. Twitching was part of tweaking, everyone knew that. But then his hands began to tremble and his pipe fell into the long grass, yellow and sear as a result of the factory work that went on out here. A moment later, his head began to jerk from side to side.
This is it, he thought with a calm that was partly relief. I finally overdid it. I'm checking out. Probably for the best.
But he didn't check out. Didn't even pass out. He slid slowly sideways, twitching and watching as a black marble rose in the red sky. It expanded to a bowling ball, then an overinflated beach ball. It went on, growing until it had eaten up the red sky.
The end of the world, he thought. Probably for the best.
For a moment he thought he was wrong because the stars came out, only they were the wrong color, they were pink, and then, oh God, they began to fall down, leaving long pink trails behind them. Next came fire, a roaring furnace, as if someone had opened a hidden trap door and loosed hell itself on Chester's Mill.
It's our treat, he muttered.
His pipe pressed against his arm, making a burn he would see and feel later. He lay twitching in the yellow grass with his eyes turned up to glabrous whites that reflected the lurid sunset.
Our Halloween treat. First the trick, then the treat.
The fire was becoming a face, an orange version of the bloody ones he'd been looking at in the clouds just before the fit fell on him. It was the face of Jesus. Jesus was scowling at him and talking to him, telling him that bringing the fire was his responsibility, his, the fire and the
purity,
he muttered as he lay in the grass.
No, the purification.
Jesus didn't look so mad now, and he was fading. Why? Because the chef had understood. First came the pink stars, then came the purifying fire. Then the trial would end. The chef stilled as the seizure passed into the first real sleep he'd had in weeks, perhaps months. When he woke up,
It was full dark. Every trace of red gone from the sky. He was chilled to the bone, but not damp. Under the dome, dew no longer fell.
12. While the chef was observing the face of Christ in that evening's infected sunset, Third Selectman Andrea Grinnell was sitting on her couch and trying to read. Her generator had quit, or had it ever run at all? She couldn't remember. But she had a gadget called a Mighty Bright Light that her sister Rose had tucked into her Christmas stocking last year. She'd never had occasion to use it until now, but it worked just fine. You clamped it to your book and turned it on. Easy peasy. So light wasn't a problem. The words, unfortunately, were. The words kept squirming around on the page, sometimes even changing places with each other. And Nora Roberts' prose, ordinarily crystal clear, made absolutely no sense. Yet Andrea kept trying, because she could think of nothing else to do. The house stank, even with the windows open. She was suffering diarrhea, and the toilet would no longer flush. She was hungry but couldn't eat. She had tried a sandwich around 5 p.m., just an inoffensive cheese sandwich, and had thrown it up in the kitchen wastebasket minutes after it was down. A shame, because eating that sandwich had been hard work. She was sweating heavily, had already changed her clothes once, probably should change them again, if she could manage to do it, and her feet kept jittering and jerking. They don't call it kicking the habit for nothing, she thought, and I'll never make the emergency meeting tonight if Jim still means to have one. Considering how her last conversation with Big Jim and Andy Sanders had gone, maybe that was good. If she showed up, they'd just bully her some more, make her do things she didn't want to do. Best she stay away until she was clear of this shit, she said, and brushed her damp hair out of her eyes. This fucking shit in my system. Once she was herself again, she would stand up to Jim Rennie. It was long overdue. She would do it in spite of her poor aching back, which was such a misery without her OxyContin, but not the white-hot agony she had expected. That was a welcome surprise. Rusty wanted her to take methadone. Methadone, for God's sake. Heroin under an alias. If you're thinking about going cold turkey, don't, he had told her. You're apt to have seizures. But he'd said it could take 10 days his way, and she didn't think she could wait that long. Not with this awful dome over the town. Best to get it over with. Having come to this conclusion, she had flushed all of her pills, not just the methadone, but a few last OxyContin pills she'd found in the back of her nightstand drawer, down the toilet. That had been just 2 flushes before the toilet gave up the ghost. And now she sat here shivering, and trying to convince herself she'd done the right thing. It was the only thing, she thought. That kind of takes the right and wrong out of it. She tried to turn the page of her book, and her stupid hand struck the Mighty Bright gadget. It went tumbling to the floor. The spot of brilliance it threw went up to the ceiling. Andrea looked at it, and was suddenly rising out of herself, and fast. It was like riding an invisible express elevator. She had just a moment to look down and see her body still on the couch, twitching helplessly. Foamy drool was slipping down her chin from her mouth. She saw the wetness spreading around the crotch of her jeans and thought, "Yep, I'll have to change again, all right. If I live through this, that is." Then she passed through the ceiling, through the bedroom above it, through the attic with its dark stacked boxes and retired lamps, and from there out into the night. The Milky Way sprawled above her. But it was wrong. The Milky Way had turned pink. And then began to fall. Somewhere, far, far below her, Andrea heard the body she had left behind. It was screaming. 13. Barbie thought he and Julia would discuss what had happened to Piper Libby on their ride out of town, but they were mostly silent, lost in their own thoughts. Neither of them said they were relieved when the unnatural red sunset finally began to fade, but both of them were. Julia tried the radio once, found nothing but WCIK booming out "All Prayed Up," and snapped it off again. Barbie spoke only once. This just after they turned off Route 119 and began to drive west along the narrower black top of the Mountain Road, where woods bulked up close on either side. Did I do the right thing? In Julia's opinion, he had done a great many right things during the confrontation in the chief's office, including the successful treatment of 2 patients with dislocations.
but she knew what he was talking about.
Yes, it was the exquisitely wrong time to try asserting command.
He agreed, but felt tired and dispirited and not equal to the job he was beginning to see before him. I'm sure the enemies of Hitler said pretty much the same thing. They said it in 1934 and they were right, in 36 and they were right, also in 38. The wrong time to challenge him, they said. And when they realized the right time had finally come, they were protesting in Auschwitz or Buchenwald.
This is not the same, she said.
You think not?
She made no reply to this, but saw his point. Hitler had been a paper hanger, or so the story went.
Jim Rennie was a used car dealer, 601, half a dozen of the other. Up ahead, fingers of brilliance shone through the trees. They printed an intaglio of shadows on the patched tar of Motton Road. There were a number of military trucks parked on the other side of the dome. It was Harlow over there at this edge of town, and 30 or 40 soldiers moved hither and yon with a purpose. All had gas masks hooked to their belts. A silver tanker truck bearing the legend, "Extreme Danger, Keep Back," had been backed up until it almost touched a door-sized shape that had been spray-painted on the dome's surface. A plastic hose was clamped to a valve on the back of the tanker. Two men were handling the hose, which ended in a wand no bigger than the barrel of a Bic pen. These men were wearing shiny all-over suits and helmets. There were air tanks on their backs. On the Chester's Mill side, there was only one spectator. Lissa Jameson, the town librarian, stood beside an old-fashioned lady's Schwinn with a milk box carrier on the rear fender. On the back of the box was a sticker reading, "When the power of love is stronger than the love of power, the world will know peace." Jimi Hendrix.
"What are you doing out here, Lissa?" Julia asked, getting out of her car.
She held up a hand to shield her eyes from the bright lights. Lissa was nervously fiddling with the ankh she wore around her neck on a silver chain. She looked from Julia to Barbie, then back to Julia again.
"I go for a ride on my bike when I'm upset or worried. Sometimes I ride until midnight. It soothes my pneuma. I saw the lights and came to the lights."
She said this in an incantatory way and let go of her ankh long enough to trace some kind of complicated symbol in the air.
"What are you doing out here?"
"Came to watch an experiment," Barbie said. "If it works, you can be the first one to leave Chester's Mill." Lissa smiled. It looked a little forced, but Barbie liked her for the effort.
"If I did that, I'd miss the Tuesday night special at Sweetbriar. Isn't it usually meatloaf?"
"Meatloaf's the plan," he agreed, not adding that if the dome was still in place the following Tuesday, the spécialité de la maison was apt to be zucchini quiche.
"They won't talk," Lissa said. "I tried."
A squat fire plug of a man came out from behind the tanker and into the light. He was dressed in khakis, a poplin jacket, and a hat with the logo of the Maine Black Bears on it. The first thing to strike Barbie was that James O. Cox had put on weight. The second was his heavy jacket, zipped to what was now dangerously close to a double chin. Nobody else, Barbie, Julia, or Lissa, was wearing a jacket. There was no need of them on their side of the dome. Cox saluted. Barbie gave it back, and it actually felt pretty good to snap one off. "Hello, Barbie," Cox said. "How's Ken?"
"Ken's fine," Barbie said, "and I continue to be the bitch that gets all the good shit."
"Not this time, Colonel," Cox said. "This time it appears you got fucked at the drive-thru."
14.
"Who's he?" Lissa whispered.
She was still working at the ankh. Julia thought she'd snap the chain soon if she kept at it.
"And what are they doing over there?" "Trying to get us out," Julia said. "And after the rather spectacular failure earlier in the day, I'd have to say they're wise to do it on the quiet."
She started forward.
"Hello, Colonel Cox. I'm your favorite newspaper editor. Good evening."
Cox's smile was, to his credit, she thought, only slightly sour.
"Ms. Shumway, you're even prettier than I imagined."
"I'll say one thing for you, you're handy with the bullshit."
Barbie intercepted her 3 yards from where Cox was standing and took her by the arms.
"What?"
she asked. "The camera." She had almost forgotten she had it around her neck until he pointed to it.
"Is it digital?"
"Sure, Pete Freeman's extra."
She started to ask why, then got it.
You think the dome will fry it?
That'd be the best-case scenario, Barbie said. Remember what happened to Chief Perkins' pacemaker.
Shit,
she said.
Shit! Maybe I've got my old Kodak in the trunk.
Lissa and Cox were looking at each other with what Barbie thought was equal fascination.
What are you going to do? She asked. Is there going to be another bang?
Cox hesitated. Barbie said, might as well come clean, Colonel. If you don't tell her, I will. Cox sighed.
You insist on total transparency, don't you?
Why not? If this thing works, the people of Chester's Mill will be singing your praises. The only reason you're playing them close is force of habit.
No. That's what my superiors have ordered.
They're in Washington, Barbie said. And the press is in Castle Rock, most of them probably watching Girls Gone Wild on pay-per-view. Out here, it's just us chickens. Cox sighed and pointed to the spray-painted door shape.
That's where the men in the protective suits will apply our experimental compound. If we're lucky, the acid will eat through, and we'll then be able to knock that piece of the dome out the way you can knock a piece of glass out of a window, after you've used a glass cutter.
And if we're unlucky? Barbie asked. If the dome decomposes, giving off some poison gas that kills us all? Is that what the gas masks are for?
Actually, Cox said, the scientists feel it more likely that the acid might start a chemical reaction that would cause the dome to catch fire.
He saw Lissa's stricken expression and added,
they consider both possibilities very remote.
They can, Lissa said, twirling her ankh. They're not the ones who'd get gassed or roasted.
Cox said, I understand your concern, ma'am.
Melissa, Barbie corrected.
It suddenly seemed important to him that Cox understand these were people under the dome, not just a few thousand anonymous taxpayers. Melissa Jameson. Lissa to her friends. She's the town librarian. She's also the middle school guidance counselor, and teaches yoga classes, I believe.
I had to give that up, Lissa said with a fretful smile. Too many other things to do.
Very nice to make your acquaintance, Mrs. Jameson. Cox said, look, this is a chance worth taking.
If we felt differently, could we stop you? She asked.
This Cox did not answer directly.
There's no sign that this thing, whatever it is weakening or biodegrading unless we're able to breach it. We believe you're in for the long haul.
Do you have any idea what caused it? Any at all?
None, Cox said.
But his eyes shifted in a way Rusty Everett would have recognized from his conversation with Big Jim. Barbie thought, why are you lying? Just that knee-jerk reaction again? Civilians are like mushrooms, keep them in the dark and feed them shit. Probably that was all it was, but it made him nervous.
It's strong, Lissa asked. Your acid, is it strong?
The most corrosive in existence, as far as we know, Cox replied.
And Lissa took two large steps back. Cox turned to the men in the spacesuits.
Are you boys about ready?
They gave him a pair of gloved thumbs up. Behind them, all activity had stopped. The soldiers stood watching with their hands on their gas masks.
Here we go, Cox said. Barbie, I suggest you escort those two beautiful ladies at least 50 yards back from...
Look at the stars, Julia said. Her voice was soft, awestruck.
Her head was tilted upward, and in her wondering face, Barbie saw the child she had been 30 years ago. He looked up and saw the Big Dipper, the Great Bear, Orion, all where they belonged, except they had smeared out of clear focus and turned pink. The Milky Way had turned into a bubblegum spill across the greater dome of the night.
Cox, he said, do you see that?
Cox looked up.
See what, the stars?
What do they look like to you?
Well, very bright, of course. No light pollution to speak of in these parts.
Then a thought occurred to him, and he snapped his fingers.
What are you seeing? Have they changed color?
They're beautiful, Lissa said.
Her eyes were wide and shining.
But scary, too.
They're pink, Julia said.
What's happening?
Nothing,
Cox said, but he sounded oddly reluctant.
What?
Barbie asked. Spill it. And added without thinking, sir.
We got the meteorological report at 1900 hours, Cox said. Special emphasis on winds, just in case, well,
just in case. Leave it at that. The jet stream's currently coming west as far as Nebraska or Kansas, dipping south, then coming up the eastern seaboard. Pretty common pattern for late October.
What's that got to do with the stars?
As it comes north, the jet passes over a lot of cities and manufacturing towns. What it picks up over those locations is collecting on the dome, instead of being whisked north to Canada and the Arctic. There's enough of it now to have created a kind of optical filter. I'm sure it's not dangerous.
Not yet, Julia said. But what about in a week or a month? Are you going to hose down our airspace at 30,000 feet when it starts getting dark in here?
Before Cox could reply, Lissa Jameson screamed and pointed into the sky. Then she covered her face. The pink stars were falling, leaving bright cone trails behind them. 15.
More dope, Piper said dreamily as Rusty listened to her heartbeat.
Rusty patted Piper's right hand. The left one was badly scraped.
No more dope, he said. You're officially stoned.
Jesus wants me to have more dope, she said in that same dreamy voice. I want to get as high as a mockingbird pie.
I believe that's elephant's eye, but I'll take it under consideration. She sat up. Rusty tried to push her back down, but he dared push on only her right shoulder, and that wasn't enough.
Will I be able to get out of here tomorrow? I have to see Chief Randolph. Those boys raped Sammy Bushy.
And could have killed you, he said. Dislocation or not, you fell extremely lucky. Let me worry about Sammy.
Those cops are dangerous.
She put her right hand on his wrist.
They can't go on being police. They'll hurt someone else.
She licked her lips.
My mouth is so dry.
I can fix that, but you'll have to lie down.
Did you take sperm samples from Sammy? Can you match them to the boys? If you can, I'll hound Peter Randolph until he makes them give DNA samples. I'll hound him day and night.
We're not equipped for DNA matching, Rusty said. Also, there are no sperm samples because Gina Buffalino washed her up at Sammy's own request.
I'll get you something to drink. All the fridges except for the ones in the lab are turned off to save juice. But there's an igloo cooler at the nurse's station.
Juice, she said, closing her eyes. Yes. Juice would be good. Orange or apple. Not V8. Too salty.
Apple, he said. You're on clear liquids tonight. Piper whispered,
I miss my dog.
Then turned her head away. Rusty thought she'd probably be out by the time he got back with her juice box. Halfway down the corridor, Twitch rounded the corner from the nurse's station at a dead run. His eyes were wide and wild. Come outside, Rusty. As soon as I get Reverend Livia... No, now, you have to see this. Rusty hurried back to room 29 and peeped in. Piper was snoring in a most unladylike way, not unusual, considering her swelled nose. He followed Twitch down the corridor, almost running to keep up with the other man's long strides.
What is it? Meaning, what now? I can't explain. You probably wouldn't believe me if I did. You have to see it for yourself.
He banged out through the lobby door. Standing in the driveway beyond the protective canopy where drop-off patients arrived were Ginny Tomlinson, Gina Buffalino, and Harriet Bigelow, a friend whom Gina had recruited to help out at the hospital. The three of them had their arms around each other, as if for comfort, and were staring up into the sky. It was filled with blazing pink stars, and many appeared to be falling, leaving long, almost fluorescent trails behind them. A shudder worked up Rusty's back. Judy foresaw this, he thought. The pink stars are falling in lines. And they were. They were. It was as if heaven itself was coming down around their ears. 16. Alice and Aiden Appleton were asleep when the pink stars began falling, but Thurston Marshall and Carolyn Sturges weren't. They stood in the backyard of the Dumagen house and watched them come down in brilliant pink lines. Some of the lines crisscrossed each other, and when this happened, pink runes seemed to stand out in the sky before fading.
Is it the end of the world? Caroline asked.
Not at all, he said. It's a meteor swarm. They're most commonly observed during autumn here in New England. I think it's too late in the year for the Perseids.
So this one's probably a wandering shower. Maybe dust and chunks of rock from an asteroid that broke up a trillion years ago. Think of that, Caro.
She didn't want to. Are meteor showers always pink?
No, he said. I think it probably looks white on the outside of the dome, but we're seeing it through a film of dust and particulate matter. Pollution, in other words. It's changed the color.
She thought about that as they watched the silent pink tantrum in the sky. There's the little boy, Aiden. When he had that fit, or whatever it was, he said...
I remember what he said. The pink stars are falling. They make lines behind them.
How could he know that? Thurston only shook his head. Carolyn hugged him tighter. At times like this, although there had never been a time exactly like this in her life, she was glad Thurston was old enough to be her father. Right now, she wished he was her father.
How could he know this was coming? How could he know?
17. Aiden had said something else during his moment of prophecy. Everyone is watching. And by 9:30 on that Monday night, when the meteor shower was at its height, that was true. The news spreads by cell phone and email, but mostly in the old way, mouth to ear. By 9:45, Main Street is full of people watching the silent fireworks display. Most are equally silent. A few are crying. Leo Lemoyne, a faithful member of the late Reverend Coggins' Holy Redeemer congregation, shouts it's the apocalypse, that he sees the four horsemen in the sky, that the rapture will begin soon, etc., etc. Sloppy Sam Verdreau, back on the street again since 3 that afternoon, sober and grumpy, tells Leo that if Leo doesn't shut up about the crock of shit, he'll be seeing his own stars. Rupe Libby of the CMPD, hand on the butt of his gun, tells them both to shut the hell up and stop scaring people. As if they're not scared already. Willow and Tommy Anderson are in the parking lot of Dippers, Willow crying with her head on Tommy's shoulder. Rose Twitchell stands beside Anson Wheeler outside Sweetbriar Rose. Both are still wearing their aprons, and they also have their arms around each other. Nori Calvert and Benny Drake are with their parents. And when Nori's hand steals into Benny's, he takes it with a thrill the falling pink stars cannot match. Jack Cale, the current manager of Food City, is in the supermarket parking lot. Jack called Ernie Calvert, the previous manager, late that afternoon and asked if Ernie would help him do a complete inventory of supplies on hand. They were well into this job, hoping to be done by midnight when the furor on Main Street broke out. Now they stand, side by side, watching the pink stars fall. Stewart and Fernald Bowie are outside their funeral parlor, gazing up. Henry Morrison and Jackie Weddington stand across from the funeral parlor with Chaz Bender, who teaches history up to the high school.
It's just a media shower, seen through a haze of pollution, Chaz tells Jackie and Henry.
But he still sounds odd. The fact that accumulating particulate matter has actually changed the color of the stars brings the situation home to people in a new way, and gradually, the weeping becomes more widespread.
It is a soft sound, almost like rain.
Big Jim is less interested in a bunch of meaningless lights in the sky than he is in how people will interpret those lights. Tonight, he expects they'll just go home. Tomorrow, though, things may be different. And the fear he sees on most faces may not be such a bad thing. Fearful people need strong leaders. And if there's one thing Big Jim Rennie knows he can provide, it's strong leadership. He's outside the police station doors with Chief Randolph and Andy Sanders. Standing below them, crowded together, are his problem children, Thibodeau, Searles, the rude Chippy, Junior's friend, Frank. Big Jim descends the steps that Libby fell down earlier.
She could have done us all a favor if she'd broken her neck, he thinks.
And taps Frankie on the shoulder. Enjoying the show, Frankie? The boy's big, scared eyes make him look 12 instead of 22 or whatever he is.
What is it, Mr. Rennie, do you know?
Meteor shower, just God saying hello to his people. Frank de Lesseps relaxes a little. We're going back inside, Big Jim says, jerking his thumb at Randolph and Andy, who are still watching the sky. We'll talk for a while, then I'll call you four in. I want you all to tell the same cotton-picking story when I do. Have you got that?
Yes, Mr. Rennie, Frankie says.
Mel Searles looks at Big Jim, his eyes like saucers and his mouth hanging loose. Big Jim thinks the boy looks like his IQ might reach all the way up to 70. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, either.
It looks like the end of the world, Mr. Rennie, he says.
Nonsense. Are you saved, son?
I guess so, Mel says.
Then you have nothing to worry about.
Big Jim surveys them one by one, ending with Carter Thibodeau. On the way to salvation tonight, young man, is all of you telling the same story? Not everyone sees the pink stars. Like the Appleton kids, Rusty Everett's little jays are fast asleep. So is Piper. So is Andre Grinnell. So is the chef, sprawled on the dead grass beside what might be America's biggest methamphetamine lab. Ditto Brenda Perkins, who cried herself to sleep on her couch with the Vader printout scattered on the coffee table before her. The dead also do not see, unless they look from a brighter place than this darkling plain where ignorant armies clash by night. Myra Evans, Duke Perkins, Chuck Thompson, and Claudette Sanders are tucked away in the Bowie funeral home. Dr. Haskell, Mr. Carty, and Rory Dinsmore are in the morgue of Catherine Russell Hospital. Lester Coggins, Dodie Sanders, and Angie McCain are still hanging out in the McCain pantry. So is Junior. He is between Dodie and Angie, holding their hands. His head aches, but only a little. He thinks he might sleep the night here. On Mountain Road in Eastchester, not far from the place where the attempt to breach the dome with an experimental acid compound is even then going on beneath the strange pink sky, Jack Evans, husband of the late Myra, is standing in his backyard with a bottle of Jack Daniels in one hand and his home protection weapon of choice, a Ruger SR-9, in the other. He drinks and watches the pink stars fall. He knows what they are, and he wishes on every one, and he wishes for death, because without Myra, the bottom has dropped out of his life. He might be able to live without her, and he might be able to live like a rat in a glass cage, but he cannot manage both. When the falling meteors become more intermittent, this is around 10:15, about 45 minutes after the shower began, he swallows the last of the Jack, casts the bottle onto the grass, and blows his brains out. He is the mill's first official suicide. He will not be the last. 18. Barbie, Julia, and Lissa Jameson watched silently as the two space-suited soldiers removed the thin nozzle from the end of the plastic hose. They put it into an opaque plastic bag with a Ziploc top, then put the bag into a metal case, stenciled with the words "hazardous materials." They locked it with separate keys, then took off their helmets. They looked tired, hot, and out of spirits. Two older men, too old to be soldiers, wheeled a complicated-looking piece of equipment away from the site of the acid experiment, which had been performed 3 times. Barbie guessed the older guys, possibly scientists from NSA, had been doing some sort of spectrographic analysis. Or trying to. The gas masks they had been wearing during the testing procedure were now pushed up on top of their heads like weird hats. Barbie could have asked Cox what the tests were supposed to show, and Cox might even have given him a straight answer, but Barbie was also out of spirits. Overhead, the last few pink meteoroids were zipping down the sky. Lissa pointed back toward Eastchester.
I heard something that sounded like a gunshot. Did you?
Probably a car backfiring or some kid shooting off a bottle rocket, Julia said. She was also tired and drawn. Once, when it became clear that the experiment, the acid test, so to speak, wasn't going to work, Barbie had caught her wiping her eyes. It hadn't stopped her from taking pictures, with her Kodak, though. Cox walked toward them, his shadow thrown in 2 different directions by the lights that had been set up. He gestured to the place where the door shape had been sprayed on the dome.
I guess this little adventure cost the American taxpayer about $750,000, and that's not counting the R&D expenses that went into developing the acid compound, which ate the paint we sprayed on there and did absolutely fuck all else.
Language, Colonel, Julia said with a ghost of her old smile.
Thank you, Madam Editor,
Cox said sourly. Did you really think this would work? Barbie asked.
No, but I didn't think I'd ever live to see a man on Mars, either. But the Russians say they're going to send a crew of 4 in 2020.
Oh, I get it, Julia said. The Martians got wind of it and they're pissed.
If so, they retaliated in the wrong country, Cox said.
And Barbie saw something in his eyes.
How sure are you, Jim? He asked softly. I beg pardon?
That the dome was put in place by extraterrestrials.
Julia took two steps forward. Her face was pale, her eyes blazing.
Tell us what you know, goddammit.
Cox raised his hand.
Stop. We don't know anything. There is a theory, however.
Yes. Marty, come over here. One of the older gentlemen who had been running tests approached the dome. He was holding his gas mask by the strap.
Your analysis?
Cox asked. And when he saw the older gentleman's hesitation,
speak freely.
Well, Marty shrugged.
Trace minerals. Soil and airborne pollutants. Otherwise, nothing. According to spectrographic analysis, that thing isn't there.
What about the HY-908? And to Barbie and the women, the acid.
It's gone, Marty said.
The thing that isn't there ate it up.
Is that possible, according to what you know?
No, but the dome isn't possible, according to what we know.
And does that lead you to believe that the dome may be the creation of some life form with more advanced knowledge of physics, chemistry, biology, whatever?
When Marty hesitated again, Cox repeated what he'd said earlier.
Speak freely.
It's one possibility. It's also possible that some earthly supervillain set it up. A real-world Lex Luthor. Or it could be the work of a renegade country like North Korea.
Who hasn't taken credit for it? Barbie asked skeptically.
I lean toward extraterrestrial, Marty said.
He knocked on the dome without wincing. He'd already gotten his little shock from it.
So do most of the scientists working on this right now. If we can be said to be working when we're not actually doing anything.
It's the Sherlock rule. When you eliminate the impossible, the answer, no matter how improbable, is what remains.
Has anyone or anything landed in a flying saucer and demanded to be taken to our leader? Julia asked.
No, Cox said.
Would you know if something had? Barbie asked, and thought, are we having this discussion, or am I dreaming it?
Not necessarily,
Cox said, after a brief hesitation.
It could still be meteorological, Marty said. Hell, even biological, a living thing. There's a school of thought that this thing is actually some kind of E. coli hybrid.
Colonel Cox, Julia said quietly, are we something's experiment? Because that's what I feel like.
Lissa Jameson, meanwhile, was looking back toward the nice houses of the Eastchester Burblet. Most of the lights there were out, either because the people who lived there had no generators, or were saving them.
That was a gunshot, she said. I'm sure that was a gunshot.
Feeling it. 1. Other than town politics, Big Jim Rennie had only one vice, and that was high school girls basketball. Lady Wildcats basketball, to be exact. He'd had season tickets ever since 1998 and attended at least a dozen games a year. In 2004, the year the Lady Wildcats won the state Class D championship, he attended all of them. And although the autographs people noticed when they were invited into his home study were inevitably those of Tiger Woods, Dale Earnhardt, and Bill Spaceman Lee, the one of which he was proudest, the one he treasured, was Hannah Compton's. The little sophomore point guard who had led the Lady Wildcats to that one and only gold ball. When you're a season ticket holder, you get to know the other season ticket holders around you and their reasons for being fans of the game. Many are relatives of the girls who play, and often the spark plugs of the booster club, putting on bake sales and raising money for the increasingly expensive away games. Others are basketball purists who will tell you, with some justification, that the girls' games are just better. Young female players are invested in a team ethic that the boys, who love to run and gun, dunk, and shoot from way downtown,
rarely match. The pace is slower, allowing you to see inside the game and enjoy every pick and roll or give and go. Fans of the girls' game relish the very low scores that boys' basketball fans sneer at, claiming that the girls' game puts a premium on defense and foul shooting, which are the very definition of old-school hoops. There are also guys who just like to watch long-legged teenage girls run around in short pants. Big Jim shared all these reasons for enjoying the sport. But his passion sprang from another source entirely, one he never vocalized when discussing the games with his fellow fans. It would not have been politic to do so. The girls took the sport personally, and that made them better haters. The boys wanted to win, yes, and sometimes a game could get hot if it was against a traditional rival. In the case of the Mills Wildcat sports teams, the despised Castle Rock Rockets. But mostly with the boys, it was about individual accomplishments, showing off, in other words, and when it was over, it was over. The girls, on the other hand, loathed losing. They took loss back to the locker room and brooded over it. More importantly, they loathed and hated it as a team. Big Jim often saw that hate rear its head. During a loose ball brawl deep in the second half with the score tied, he could pick up that, "No you don't, you little bitch, that ball is mine," vibe. He picked it up and fed on it. Before 2004, the Lady Wildcats made the state tournament only once in 20 years, that appearance a one-and-done affair against Buckfield. Then had come Hannah Compton, the greatest hater of all time, in Big Jim's opinion. As the daughter of Dale Compton, a scrawny pulp cutter from Tarker's Mills who was usually drunk and always argumentative, Hannah had come by her out-of-my-face-tude naturally enough. As a freshman, she had played JV for most of the season. Coach swung her up to varsity only for the last two games, where she'd outscored everyone and left her opposite number from the Richmond Bobcats writhing on the hardwood after a hard but clean defensive play. When that game was over, Big Jim had collared Coach Woodhead. "If that girl doesn't start next year, you're crazy," he said. "I'm not crazy," Coach Woodhead had replied. Hannah had started hot and finished hotter, blazing a trail that Wildcats fans would still be talking about years later. Season average 27.6 points per game. She could spot up and drop a three-pointer anytime she wanted, but what Big Jim liked best was to watch her split the defense and drive for the basket, her pug face set in a sneer of concentration, her bright black eyes daring anyone to get in her way, her short ponytail sticking out behind her like a raised middle finger. The Mills' second selectman and premier used car dealer had fallen in love. In the 2004 championship game, the Lady Wildcats had been leading the Rock Rockets by 10 when Hannah fouled out. Luckily for the Cats, there was only a buck 16 left to play. They ended up winning by a single point. Of their 86 total points, Hannah Compton had scored a brain-freezing 63. That spring, her argumentative dad had ended up behind the wheel of a brand new Cadillac, sold to him at cost, minus 40% by James Rennie Sr. New cars weren't Big Jim's business, but when he wanted one, off the back of the carrier, he could always get it. Sitting in Peter Randolph's office with the last of the pink meteor shower still fading away outside, and his problem children waiting, anxiously, Big Jim hoped, to be summoned and told their fate. Big Jim recalled that fabulous, that outright mythic basketball game. Specifically, the first 8 minutes of the second half, which had begun with the Lady Wildcats down by 9. Hannah had taken the game over with the single-minded brutality of Joseph Stalin taking over Russia, her black eyes glittering and seemingly fixed upon some basketball nirvana beyond the sight of normal mortals. Her face locked in that eternal sneer that said, "I'm better than you, I'm the best, get out of my way or I'll run you the fuck down." Everything she threw up during that 8 minutes had gone in, including one absurd half-court shot that she launched when her feet tangled together, getting rid of the rock just to keep from being called for traveling. There were phrases for that sort of run, the most common being in the zone. But the one Big Jim liked was feeling it, as in, she's really feeling it now. As though the game had some divine texture beyond the reach of ordinary players.
although sometimes even ordinary players felt it, and were transformed for a brief while into gods and goddesses, every bodily defect seeming to disappear during their transitory divinity. A texture that, on special nights, could be touched. Some rich and marvelous drape such as must adorn the hardwood halls of Valhalla. Hannah Compton had never played her junior year. The championship game had been her valedictory. That summer, while driving drunk, her father had killed himself, his wife, and all three daughters while driving back to Tarker's Mills from Brownies, where they had gone for ice cream fraps. The bonus Cadillac had been their coffin. The multiple fatality crash had been front-page news in Western Maine. Julia Shumway's Democrat published an issue with a black border that week. But Big Jim had not been grief-stricken. Hannah never would have played college ball, he suspected. There the girls were bigger, and she might have been reduced to role-player status. She never would have stood for that. Her hate had to be fed by constant action on the floor. Big Jim understood completely. He sympathized completely.